didn't even get a chance to talk about the Manchester derby, which I know you were very keen to. What's your ideal outcome of that game, by the way?
Manchester United win, the no threat to Liverpool, and Manchester City are. It's as simple as that.
OTB AM live weekday mornings from 7:30 on the OTB Sports app.
OTB AM
with Gillette, proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow.
All right, it's bang on 7:30 this Monday morning. Very welcome along to OTB AM. Jerry Gilroy and Johnny Ward with you all the way through until 10. If you've got anything you want to get off your chest, feel free to get in touch. You can get us on 0879 180 180, WhatsApp or text, or of course you can leave a comment on the YouTube stream. Johnny, not a bad weekend sport all around. You'd have to say, for fans of narrative, there was plenty of it knocking around.
That ultimately is what it's all about. Give us something to talk about in this very, very troubling world, Jer. You know, football was pretty amazing over the weekends. The Manchester United defeat, I don't think, was unpredictable. The performance wasn't unpredictable, but Liverpool have weighed in on the narrative as well. By, didn't see the game yesterday, but conceding 3 goals, 2 bad performances back to back against teams that they'd expect to be competitive against.
Yeah, Burnley scoring late against Chelsea.
Yeah, the Burnley result was mad as well, and obviously Arsenal's kind of revival as well, continuing. West Ham having an unbelievable season.
Norwich sacked their manager after their first win of the season.
Yeah, you were speaking about this before we came on, the potential repercussions for Andrew Mbeumo because he started the last couple of games, and obviously Farke, who seems to be quite a good guy actually, clearly has faith in him, even started him left back against Rafinha, against Leeds, and I think he played centre back the weekend. So that might be a worry for him, but I think the way he's playing, it'll be interesting. Maybe in Queeving Kelleher as well, will start wondering, will he get a game? Because Alisson, by all accounts, did not play well yesterday and probably hasn't been quite the player he was since he came back last season.
You can't drop your keeper that, right?
Cause no, he's not going to.
There's no coming back from that.
No, but it's interesting. Just Liverpool looking shaky at the back all of a sudden. And yeah, Kelleher will. It's an interesting one for Kelleher. What does he do going forward? Because, you know, his Irish rival, Bazunu, is just doing so well on loan that it's a tough one for Kelleher. He's Liverpool's third or fourth choice keeper then was in goal, conceding 3 for Pats against Sligo on Friday night, albeit that didn't really matter to Pats. But lots happened on the football front.
Yeah,
the end.
Like, and we haven't even... So Bazunu, there's a picture that the FAI stuck out last night. I don't know, was it around 7 or 8, 9 o'clock, of him visiting the Rovers underage team who've been successful this week. Was it the under-17 team just dropping in on them? And you can imagine the excitement that it's like, well, this guy's playing for Ireland. Mm. And, you know, he's going to be playing against Ronaldo on Thursday night at a full house de Aviva. And he was us 4 or 5 years ago or even less. It's pretty impressive. And it was just good to see. I mean, I don't know if he's chatting to them or giving them any advice or whatever, but there was that. And the other thing is Antonio Conte's first substitution. It's a dual substitution. But he looks down his bench and he goes, yeah, Doherty, you, I like the cut of your jib, in you go. That's good.
It's definitely good, yeah, because, you know, in fairness to Doherty, he was a player that seemed to be able to completely shrug aside his club troubles when he came playing for Ireland. He's been really, really good for Ireland. I think, you know, if the dilemma for Stephen Kenny is interesting because he's obviously settled on this...
Well, hold your thoughts on that dilemma, because we'll talk about all that in the performance rankings. Here's what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock this morning. It's 7:33. You're watching OTB AM, or maybe you're just listening to us as a radio show. You can do that on the OTB Sports app. Our performance rankings are coming at 7:40. Daniel Harris is going to look back on specifically the Man United game and some of the other big stories in the Premier League as well at 8:05. We've got the sports pages at 8:25. Michael Verney's going to join us. Colin Fenley has officially confirmed that he has retired from intercounty hurling. We're going to talk rugby with Quinny and Hayes at 9:05. Owen in the US at 9:30 talking with Jack Chambers, and the Sunday papers from 9:45. A quick look back at some of the major headlines. But now at 7:34, let's get into the performance rankings.
You know, that wasn't an All-Ireland winning performance.
Probably should have won the game based on the second half performance.
Is it a step too far to say it was the performance so far of the World Cup? Maybe not.
OTBAN's performance rankings with Gillette.
I'm scratching my head. Our performances was just lacked that intensity.
Ooh, didn't even mention Roy Keane. Speaking of lacking intensity, yeah, I presume you've seen the footage of Keane and Man United fans outside after yesterday. Have you seen that?
No, I saw quite a bit of his analysis with Micah Richards and Graeme Souness and Gary Neville after the game. I didn't see that.
I didn't see that much. I saw a little bit of it where he was just doing his, oh, I'm a broken man here. I'm sorry for the players. They're not Man United players. And then by that stage, I was flicking back. But stuff has gone viral on Twitter of Man United fans giving it to Keane.
Mm.
And there's just a moment in it where Keane's like, I've been here signing autographs for ages. Oh, you've had a few drinks, have you? You've had two or three pints. And then he takes two steps forward in the altercation and there's a big intake of breath where he's like, where's this going?
What a hero.
I mean, you shouldn't really be getting into it with the drunk fans.
No, you shouldn't.
Nature and life, a lifetime of being involved around drunk fans tells you what's going to happen here.
Yeah.
You're going to get filmed. They're going to brag to their mates that they wound up Roy Keane.
Mm.
And you're going to end up looking pretty bad. And he's on the front of the papers, but...
He's never, like, Roy, has he ever been more relevant at 50? Like, you know, I know Paul McCartney's trying to stay relevant at 80-odd or whatever. But Keane, just, like, everything he says is...
Much and all as I love Roy Keane, I think probably Paul McCartney's had a bigger impact on pop culture.
He has, although I think Keane's had a bigger impact on my life, to be fair. But, you know, he's still, it's like, even yesterday the headlines were ex-United captains, you know, ex-United greats, whatever, Round and Solskjaer. Was Saturday the beginning of the end, or down the road of the end?
I think that was they were finally abandoning ship, right? There was no redeeming feature. Let's stick up our performance record.
Yeah.
Man United are in the red. So this is our first one. Manchester United, we've got Villa, we've got Wales, we've got Irish rugby and Irish football. This is actually a weekly competition. If you want to win a Gillette starter pack, then get involved. Leave a comment on the YouTube channel. Tell us who you think should be in which colour and we'll pick an entry between now and 10 a.m. this morning. So a reminder that OTBAM is with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. So Manchester United, right?
Yeah.
Why are they in the red?
Why are they in the red? They were in the red, I think, the last time I was on the show as well. But this was this is the nadir, I think, really. And it's still interesting just to look at, if you're the owners of Manchester United, what do you do with Solskjaer? Because 17 points, they're 6 points off second at the moment. So in terms of like their European ambitions, it's not irretrievable. And some of their, you know, Liverpool are showing a few kinks, so, you know, Man United will still hope that they could finish in the top four or whatever, but they won't under Solskjaer, clearly, you know, because he has brought in Ronaldo, which itself, like, we debated this a lot at the time, it was a big gamble in terms of the actual football side of the game. If you want to look at every other side of Manchester United, it was probably a great thing to do. But Ronaldo coming in, and Ronaldo personally himself has done extremely well since he came in, but it's just the problems that creates elsewhere. And also what the other strikers have done since Ronaldo has come in, they've just been... They haven't lifted their game. And Man United can't play against a team like Man City. And what I thought was hilarious was apparently Solskjaer said we're going to start on the front foot against Man City. Like, that's so far removed from reality. Manchester United are completely incapable of playing on the front foot against Manchester City, particularly when you have somebody like Ronaldo on the team. When Ronaldo is on the team, you can't do that much off the ball.
I disagree with that. I'll tell you that.
Disagree with what then?
Well, I think that if Pep Guardiola had
a team of Ronaldo.
Yeah, or if Klopp had somehow inherited Cristiano Ronaldo, he'd be able to make him work. And that's the thing, is that, like, a good manager would actually be able to fix this scenario.
But he wouldn't have signed him.
To go back to, so I said inherited, but Guardiola was trying to sign him. We know that he was. We know that for a fact. We absolutely, that is 100%, they were trying to sign him, and that ultimately was one of the reasons why Man United jumped in and signed him. If you go back to the time, the narrative was, he's definitely going to make the team better. He's Ronaldo, he's one of the best footballers in the world, of course he will. We took that as one of those truisms, and that has turned out not to be necessarily true. He has done a lot of very amazing things, but is the team actually better than they were last year? In games like this, for example, are they better? No, because there's no identity. And it goes back to the issue with Solskjaer not being a particularly good manager. I think that's why they're trapped in a purgatory at the moment.
Yeah, and there are issues defensively as well that are probably part of a more general malaise, like Maguire's performances this season and so forth. I mean, if you looked at the ratings yesterday on Saturday, De Gea got 9 and everyone else got 4 or 5. And De Gea still, exactly, De Gea still threw one in.
I'm not sure I'd be giving him a 9 after throwing the one in.
Probably give him an 8, but he had an outstanding first half apart from that. But the Man United, in fairness, last year with the pace they had on the break, they were well able to, you know, match up against teams like Man City and soak up pressure but play on the break, and they were a real threat on the break. They're not really a threat on the break anymore, and they don't have any identity where they're going. And I don't see them finishing in the top four under Ronaldo or under Solskjaer. I can't see it happening at all. They have the Pogba issue as well. When Pogba comes back from suspension, what do they do with him? He disgraced himself against Liverpool. In some respects, this was more humiliating than the Liverpool game, because it was embarrassing. Like they were being toyed with throughout.
I can't accept that, right? Because at the end, when the history books are written and when you're going through the history books, there'll be a 5-0 beside the Liverpool game, and there'll be a 2-0 beside this, and we won't, you know, in 3 years' time. Okay, so next season, everybody will remember it. That was the game where it could really have been 5 or 6 if City had turned the screw. City didn't bother turning the screw, but then City can't turn the screw in games like that. They haven't. They tend not to beat teams like that. But I actually still think the Liverpool one, for all sorts of historic reasons, is more humiliating. There's a beautiful historic importance around the 5-0s in the Classicos. Mm. Like it's a big kind of. We snatch you down and you're dead.
And look at Liverpool's performances since.
Look,
if you look at form lines in horse racing, it doesn't even really stack up. Like, Liverpool do have vulnerabilities.
Villa's manager was sacked. Last win was against United at Old Trafford.
Mm, the only way win they've had all season. Do you know what is? We spoke about this Saturday as well. These games should not be played. Manchester United, Man City should not be played that early on Saturday.
I heard you guys.
The
atmosphere was great. There was a non-stop Ollie's at the wheel from the City fans. You could hear it resonating around the stadium. I think there's no atmosphere because Man United are crap. That's the problem.
Yeah, I think I think the fans went into that game probably expecting little more than what they got. But the pantomime continues. Like, they've literally every time I'm on the show, we're talking about Ollie Gunnar Solskjaer for about 3 years now. It's like, just get him out of the way and let me get on with my life.
So the point you made about finishing the top four, that's the thing that we've always said is the main trigger for the owners to get rid of him.
I don't think they particularly care about winning things. I really don't. I think the balance sheet is all good. Like,
well, yeah, they care about qualifying for the Champions League. Mm. That's the be all and end all. That's the victory or defeat. And I think, in a weird way, Arsenal's scratchy 1-0 win against Watford yesterday might be the most important result of the weekend from Man United's perspective. And perhaps West Ham beating Liverpool, because it suggests that instead of there just being a baked in top four that we knew was going to be Chelsea, City, Liverpool, and they would have assumed Manchester United, all of a sudden it looks realistic that the run Mikel Arteta's team are on, and particularly the run that David Moyes' team are on, means that the top six is a top six and not a top four.
And Spurs as well. Like, Spurs are, like, under Conte could definitely improve. The good thing for Spurs was that they actually won 5 of their 10 games before he came in. So their points tally, 15, is probably flattering in terms of the season that they've had. But if you win games rather than draw games with the 3 points for a win, it just helps you up the table. So they're not that far off. They're only 6 points off Liverpool. And Conte will hope that they'd improve. I think Everton will have a good season. Manchester United at the moment, I'm only speculating on XG, but in terms of their performances, there's no way that they're going to finish in the top four. They've been, since Ronaldo has come in, basically, they've been really poor. And I'm not blaming Ronaldo on this, but just the whole shape of their team is wrong. And there's something not right there. They've been really, really poor in games. They've given away goals very cheaply. And they didn't lay a glove on City, really. It was really pathetic and embarrassing. But I don't know if the players, either physically or mentally, were able to do any more at the state that they're in at the moment. They had the one chance where Ronaldo's shot was saved. The rebound they could have scored. That was it. And every single Manchester City player, outfield player, had more touches than the player who touched the ball most for Manchester United, which is really depressing, particularly in a game where you're 1-0 down for most of it when you should have the ball because you're pressing to get an equaliser.
Yeah, they were completely
Four touches in the opposition box.
Yeah. Is that the lowest since records began or something? Was that the...
When did records begin, I wonder? Long before the days of XG and so on, but...
0-2, sometime around then, I think.
I don't think Solskjaer can really come back from this, because he's had, like, the rally against Spurs was fake because Spurs were a joke. So that basically their performances have been rubbish for some time now, and I mean, don't see his way out.
The Spurs thing is going to be one of those most interesting sliding doors moments in world football for the next 18 months, where whoever is the next manager won't be Antonio Conte as a result of the fact that Spurs acted more quickly after Manchester United beat them. So the door slid. Spurs went behind door number one, Antonio Conte. Man United went, yeah, you're going to keep Ole Gunnar Solskjaer for another week or two, or maybe until Christmas, or maybe until the end of the season. Oh no, we didn't qualify for the Champions League. Who's going to manage us now?
There are managers out there. It's not like, you know, I don't know enough about world football to say, but there clearly are very good, promising young coaches. Like, there are definitely, and I mean this for a fact, there are managers in the League of Ireland that would do a better job than Solskjaer is doing, 100%, including probably Damien Duff.
Well, I mean, Duffer doesn't have the experience. You can't.
I'd still suspect he'd... Solskjaer's doing a rank bad job at the moment.
It's not. I mean,
probably wouldn't be. Would he be able to deal with Pogba and the Eagles? Actually, Duffer just get rid of a load of them. He'd Pogba be gone because he's wielded the proverbial axe at Shells. Well, anyone he doesn't like would be just gone.
They should have got rid of Pogba last summer after the World Cup when they had the opportunity to get anything for him, get 50 cents on the dollar, whatever it was, because he hasn't been an impactful player more often than not, and you are spending a lot of money and he sets the bar for what everybody expects in terms of wages. There's loads of different reasons for that. They should probably get rid of De Gea next summer as well, because he's massively overpaid for as a goalkeeper go. And I know the money is not supposed to be important, but ultimately it creates an architecture and an ecosystem in the dressing room where people expect
people definitely underestimate that, Gerard. It's not, and people say, like, why would you care if you're on another 100 grand a month or 100 grand a week when you've so much money? But it's all about hierarchy, and it's like, I've spoken to ex-players about this. There's real resentment there if there's a player who you think is either on your level or inferior to you and is on exponentially more money than you. It creates disharmony, and it's a big problem for any club. Like, say next season, if the likes of, in the League of Ireland, if Derry City are getting a lot more money, how do you bring in players? But you have players already on contractual situations. You can't bring in players and pay them double, because it creates a complete shit show.
Well, you can, and it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. It doesn't work, and it's not. You have to have. If say, like, if Pogba were, like, absolutely breaking records and doing everything week in, week out, then you can say, that's
no
fine.
Problem. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah, Ronaldo's worth the money. Pogba's worth the money. But he's not. And his tackle against Liverpool and Ronaldo's tackle against Liverpool, it was symptomatic of a dressing room that isn't functioning.
Okay, so that's Manchester United in the red. If you are a Man United fan, we'd love to hear from you. You can leave a comment in the YouTube stream and we'll get to that. Or, of course, you can get us on 0879 180 180. Villa in the red as well. So it's mad. 5 weeks ago, Villa won 1-0 at Manchester United at Old Trafford. They rode out one of those late comeback storms, and Dean Smith's gone at the weekend. As a Villa fan, I definitely felt a lot of sympathy for the Man United fans who want Solskjaer to succeed. That's the other side of this, is that, like, you really desperately want somebody from your club who knows it, who wants it to work, because it does actually mean more. I can legitimately say that being a Villa fan with Dean Smith as the manager meant more to me than when David O'Leary was the manager, or Houllier, or any of that other group who came really since John Gregory. And Brian Little,
Brian Little's a top man, isn't
Steve
he?
Steve Bruce, like, you fall out of loving the club when it's just a randomer managing it. And, like, they're all professional managers and they're all doing what they think is the best for them and therefore also for the club, you would argue. But it does mean more when somebody who is a fan of the club is in charge and who feels, ultimately, it didn't work out because they've gone into a horrific slump. He seems to have lost confidence. The players seem to have lost confidence, and the players who were playing well and were achieving last season are no longer performing for him. And
what's his records in Grealish left for?
They
example?
Laid big eggs in the transfer window. His record without Grealish is pretty bad over the last, because Grealish was injured for a while and then came back. I think it was something like 16 defeats in 30 games. Like, it's close enough to relegation for him. And so they get sucked into the relegation mire. And now they're going to say, let's give it to Stevie G. I'm like, I'm not really sure about
Stevie
that either.
G, take it.
I'd be surprised if... Why would you not take the Newcastle gig if you were going to take one of these gigs? We didn't even mention Eddie Howe in the stands at the game at the weekend.
The Gerrard situation will be interesting, because obviously we know he wants the Liverpool job, but his next job's going to be interesting as well. I'd say there's still an asterisk over what he's achieving in English football at Rangers, because, like, it's just not comparable. And the Villa job probably would be a tough job to go into. It's a competitive Premier League, and
the other ones are Ralf Hasenhüttl. He's been linked with it, and there was somebody else. Oh, the Denmark manager. The Denmark manager sounds pretty interesting, because he is the one who Denmark had qualified for the Euros, and they took the manager out because he was playing too boring football, and they put in the new manager. And then obviously what happened at the Euros happened, but, like, by all accounts he plays very good progressive football. Now, can you stick one of those managers in who doesn't know the Premier League in the middle of the season? Premier League players are notoriously,
Who are you?
Yeah,
you've never played here before.
I'm like, oh, come on, just do what he tells you and you might get better. But it seems
they
to
have
matter.
The players to kind of, Like, you look at the teams around them, like Southampton, Leeds, Leicester, it's not like they're surrounded by crap teams either. Like,
no, Leicester's situation in the league, is it clearly being impacted by all the speculation around Brendan Rodgers, or are they being found out?
They're 15 points from 11, like, as well. They've 4 wins. Like, so they're probably not much better than that, are they? I mean, they're probably more of a mid-table team that have punched above their weight a bit in recent seasons. Vardy's getting older. Like, Leeds is a strange one for me, that I expected Leeds to be doing better than that.
It's all of a sudden a very, very competitive.
It's very competitive. And in the way it's structured financially, it kind of should be that way, in that, like, it's not really dependent on what crowds you get. Like, the lower teams are, well, they get plenty of money for being in the Premier League. And that's the funny thing about this season. You don't really trust... Like, most teams, you don't trust them to definitely win week to week, because it is competitive. No, and look at Liverpool. Like,
well, and actually look at Burnley being able to come from one down at Chelsea. That's very impressive. It's that you concede, and it's a shitty goal to concede, like a free header for Kai Havertz from 6 yards out. You're like, oh,
win the game.
On.
Tuchel's performance after was interesting. He didn't seem that perturbed. He seemed fairly happy with life. Now, they're still 3 points ahead, but... Like, the West Ham story is quite incredible. Like, 23 points from 11 games, yeah. Beating Liverpool, scoring swashbuckling goals.
Yeah. Very impressive. Very, very impressive.
Moyes just obviously...
Good manager. Not very good manager. Right, so that's Villa in the red. Is it Gerrard time? I'm saying no. Give me somebody else.
Who would have been your favourite Villa manager from those you reeled off, actually?
Well, John Gregory, because like, he was aggressive and then ultimately signed really badly at the end and cost him the chance of winning the league and stopping Man United becoming the juggernaut they became.
Mm.
It's actually his fault.
I'd forgotten that.
If they hadn't signed... It was Bosco Balaban was the biggest waste of money, but even Juan Pablo Angel. So they went to River Plate... And they watched Pablo Aimar, Juan Pablo Angel, and Riquelme, I think, in the same game.
Riquelme, what a
baller.
And
they picked Juan Pablo Angel. I'm like, if you pick either of the other two. That's wrong, because Riquelme played for Boca, so I've got that wrong. But they were down there in that general vicinity, shopping around, going, oh, we'll take this guy. And then he signs for like $9 million, which is a massive amount of money at the time, and scores a goal every other year.
The football, on a complete tangent, but the football agent stuff is very, very interesting, and it's becoming a big thing in Ireland now, because there are so many young kids who are starring at underage League of Ireland level who are obviously not going to Britain, and there's a scrap for them. And it's made me wonder, like, what makes a good football agent? Like, is it what he can see, or is it how he can deal with people, or what is it like? And this isn't
how much money he can get for his client.
At this level, it's not quite like that. It's more spotting the players and treating them well, like, because there isn't fortunes in it per se. Like, so it's not like you're top dudes, but it's interesting. It's a very interesting world, and nearly everyone has an agent now. Even at League of Ireland level, you're represented by someone.
Yeah, well, they probably need one as well. It's seven.
Can you go to a game and tell, like, I'm here to watch A, but can you say, listen, like, this fullback is just, you've got to sign him. Over the course of 90 minutes, I've seen enough, him.
You've got Wisecout that's saying, here are the stats to back this up. And yeah. What are you looking for? So it fits into, if you can talk the language of the data analysts who are looking after the Sevilla youth team and say, you need a left back who will touch the ball 14 times and make 7 forward passes. This is the profile. Yeah. This is the amount of running you can do. That's how that works.
I am worried about that, though, as well. Like, please don't let all football teams just be based on, like, their GPS data and all that. Like, all the characters going to be gone out of the game?
So the assumption that you can't perform well statistically and also be a character is a false duality.
No, but it's like you have to work so hard off the ball now. It's like where was your Matt Letizia's or your, you know, the languid players who kind of...
Yeah, I mean... Do you know, we're the lazy ones.
Do we want everyone to just work really hard for the team, come off in 60 minutes and be happy and say, yes, I did for the team?
Could Matt Letizia have been, like, genuinely world class
if he worked
dominated, like, one of the big European leagues at the highest level and won multiple European Cups? Yeah, he probably could have. Do you know, like, he could have won a World Cup, but I mean, he's probably happy. Every Monday morning on OTBM, we give you the chance to win a Gillette starter pack. All you got to do is enter. All you have to do to enter is get in touch with your suggestions. Who should be in the red? Who should be in the amber? And who should be in the green? Red is bad. Amber is okay. We're going to have a little chat about that. And then green is obviously go, go, go. Wales are in the amber. Poor Wales.
What happened here?
We have failed you on this show, Wales, because we didn't troll you before the New Zealand game and you got your absolute asses handed to you by the All Blacks. That happens. It might well happen to us next weekend. I don't know. And I apologise on behalf of OTBAM for not taunting you enough so that we inspired you to greatness. But this weekend,
I think this photo,
this was the most Welsh thing that I've ever seen in my life. So you've got the Springboks, the world champions, the team who just sorted out the Lions pretty handily, and they're on their European tour, and it's a level 15 all, I think, is the score, and there's like 13 minutes left in the game. Wales are attacking. It's a beautiful, vibrant move. Ball comes to Liam Williams. He's going to run it in. He's going to saunter in, touch it down. Yeah. The Millennium Stadium with no roof on it for whatever reason, and everybody getting wet. So, yeah. That's what happens in most realities. In whatever simulation we're in at the moment, some drunken Welsh fan clambers over, waving to the crowd, telling everybody what he's going to do, and everybody's watching him, wearing his poppy, obviously.
Obviously.
Obviously, because you have to. And he stops on the sideline, and then he gets in onto the field to play. Gets on the field to play. Now, that's the last one. You need to start. So there he is on the ground, right? So that's him in the middle there. In the middle of our shot, he's on the ground being attended to. And that's Liam Williams in the top left-hand corner. And that's four South Africans who've managed to make it to Liam Williams, because Liam Williams had to stop and check his run because some clown had got on the field of play and got in his way. You're like, what are you doing? There he is. There's where Liam Williams gets the ball. And now look how far away everybody is. Maybe the pass was a little bit behind him, and maybe our alternative reality is fake, but look how far away the four South Africans are. And then all of a sudden they're like right on him, because he had to stop because he couldn't just run straight through to the line, even though they created the space.
What's your feeling towards the guy who went onto the pitch right now?
What are you doing?
See, the sad, like, so if you were a journalist and you said, you know, you went into your editor on a Monday morning, if this even happens anymore, and the editor said, I want you to find out the life story of this man, it'd be interesting, because he may be,
well,
you know,
it's hard to know if it would be interesting or not, because apparently there's this thing which I'm blissfully unaware of.
Maybe he was just hammered.
There was a guy who made it into the anthems the previous week. It must have been at the Millennium Stadium, and then he made it into the anthems at the Aviva. You see this guy?
I didn't. You were talking to me. We've had that in racing a lot as well. I find that stuff just pathetic, to be honest.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so I don't even want to talk about it, because you just end up, this is like, yeah, oh, they talked about me there, they talked about me there, and look how amazing I am, they're talking about me. So would it really be interesting to find out about a guy who gets so drunk at the game that he thinks he's going to be the lad for the next ages? I don't know. Is your editor sitting down going, I want to know the life story of this guy? Is your editor actually like a little bit out of touch going, no, that's just some tryhard who wants his 15 seconds of TikTok fame?
There might be that. But why did he do it? And what, like, there are repercussions for somebody who does that for someone's family. Like, it's embarrassing. It's shameful. And, you know, it's like, he's the guy who made an ass of himself going onto the pitch now. And fair enough, Wales didn't score a try or whatever, but it does matter in this sport and context. And he's, you know, there's an iconic image of him just being on the floor there while Wales have a try basically that they won't score because he was on the pitch
and
jeans.
Look, everybody in this show knows how much we love South Africa, so if they both could have lost the weekend, we'd have been happy. As it turned out, Wales humiliated themselves unnecessarily, and they gave South Africa the victory. Fair play to everybody.
You mean their humiliation was their fan?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's not Wales humiliating themselves.
Well, that's the whole country. The whole country is embarrassed.
What should the punishment be for somebody who does that?
I think you should actually be banned for life from going to any rugby matches, any sports matches again. It's like you can't be trusted to look after yourself until you make reparation. Whatever that is, you decide.
You're a bit back to society. Back.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think you should be put in prison or anything, but... Although at the same time, like, you know, it's not, there's a safety element here. We live in a very, very toxic world where people might get ideas about this and go, well, you know.
It's interesting as well that, you know, we've had this debate about football and rugby, about boozing at games, and there has been talk about like bringing in kind of being able to have a pint basically whilst watching a Premier League game. And I think even in football, people are like, yeah, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
It's maybe, in like it's
a
an
window
interesting dynamic.
Of 90 minutes not drinking isn't the worst thing that's happened in people's lives.
No, or like you can do at the Aviva Stadium, you can have your beer at half time, but you can't re-enter the. like, I kind of think that's probably the best way to go. You can't trust 50,000 people in a raucous atmosphere or otherwise to all behave themselves if they're boozed up, basically. But obviously in rugby, normally it's fine because they're very upstanding people. We've
two more greens to come, the Ireland rugby team and the Ireland football team. So from the Ireland...
Green shoots.
Well, exactly. From the Ireland football team's perspective, and we'll get into this a little bit later on in the week in more detail, but the fact that Doherty comes off the bench at least, and one report I read said he came on at left wing back, which is probably where he's going to play for Ireland. The fact that he was up against Seamus Coleman played the full 90 minutes, he's fit. A lot of our players seem to have got a bit of fitness and a bit of form. Some don't. That's the way it goes. But like, there's nobody at the moment who you would say, right, it's a disaster for us that we don't have this player. Even Alan Brown's back, missed the game at the weekend, but is in the squad this morning, we're being told. Now, sometimes that happens. He shows up and they send him home. So we'll see. Hopefully, fingers crossed, he will be fit. But it looks like he's got his full deck to deal with for these two games. The Portugal game is obviously a massive game for the fans, but the biggest game from Kenny's perspective is going to be winning in Luxembourg.
Yeah, yes and no. Like, the Portugal game is the game that everyone... No, I don't think anyone is thinking of Luxembourg at the moment. So the Portugal game, we should have gotten something in Faro. And I still think that if we actually played a bit more... If Stephen Kenny were a little bit braver in the second half, I think we could have actually put them to the sword. Maybe brought on like an offensive player rather than James McLean, because they were absolute ramshackle at the back. And we were inviting pressure, I think, by... This is just my thoughts now, and we did create chances, but I think in the last 20 minutes, half an hour, they were still there for the take, and McLean did poorly when he came on as well defensively. But now McLean comes into the argument because he's actually played very well the last couple of games.
He's playing well for Wigan, he's scoring goals.
Yeah, it's flying.
He was out of form at club level at that stage.
Yeah.
So that doesn't make the most sense. Mind you, Conley, I think, was pushed in the back. It probably was a penalty.
Yeah, it's a bit of the boy by the wolf of Conley. But
if Ronaldo scores the penalty, which you would expect him to do against Bazunu, is that a 5-0?
I spoke at this at the time. That was like, I don't know, it was one of the most defining moments of the Irish football story, because Bazunu screws up effectively by hitting the ball a bit too short. And he's... Interestingly, Ireland have sort of abandoned that style of football since. Which I don't disagree with, to be honest. I think
I don't think we've abandoned it. I think we just...
We do it a lot less.
Like, that's different from abandoning it.
There is no way he's going to try that pass on Thursday. No way. None whatsoever. They tried against Serbia.
We do when it's suitable. We still play out from the back from time to time. But it's not just a blind...
Show me against even Qatar and Azerbaijan anything that resembled remotely that, or the one where it was a Duffy give the ball away in the box against Serbia and Lanzarote rolled when they probably...
So we just got better at it. That's what I'm saying. I'm agreeing with you largely.
I think we're not really doing the really high risk stuff at the moment. The point is, Bazuna did that, but he's like, whatever. I'm just going to get up and save a penalty from Ronaldo here. And I thought that was like, if Ronaldo had scored, Ireland could have been absolutely battered.
Yeah.
And on Thursday, let's be honest, if Portugal turn it on, remember when we played Serbia at home, we were absolutely pummeled for 80 minutes, 70 minutes, whatever. We'd hardly any of the ball. We fashioned a goal and we rallied. But the bottom line is we were given a kick in for that. So what's the progress we've made since then? Because it's hard to tell from games against Qatar and Azerbaijan.
Yeah.
So that'll be very, very interesting. How we shape up, and as people have said, the onus is on you more at home, whether you like it or not.
I think the fact that Duffy, Egan, Omar Bamadeli, Coleman and Doherty are playing a little bit of football, the combined number of minutes of those back five will be much higher than it would have been at any point in recently, like in the last
totally
game. So I think that helps.
And Bazunu, so our back six,
I think, yeah, and Bazunu, and I think we know who our midfield is first choice. It's if Alan Brown is back and fit and ready to go, and I think he's got full capacity to play the two games, then he'll probably play. And it's just, look, we know the identity of the team more or less. It's not a complete mystery to us. And that's I think
they'll go in there in great shape mentally. I think that's the point as well. But the onus on our midfielders and Robinson, it'll be tough. While saying at the same time, Portugal are definitely vulnerable defensively. And I do wonder about their dressing room at times as well, because Serbia have been the best team in the group, even though the sum of their parts would suggest probably Portugal should be. Portugal were poor against us for most of the game.
Yeah, I'd say there'll be a little bit of doubt in their minds. And
absolutely.
I'm not ruling out a potential something.
I can definitely see us getting a result. Definitely. I genuinely can.
That would be great. And the last one in green is obviously the rugby team.
Tell me about this, Ger. So I'm expecting Japan coming over. I'm expecting something of a game here. And like I look at this, how do Ireland win 65?
Well, it's Japan's fourth game since the World Cup because of COVID. So you have to definitely take into consideration that. But the upward trend of the Ireland team since the end of the Six Nations is clear. The other thing that happened, which I think is the most significant thing that happened, is that our first choice players, our best first choice players, were all fit at the same time for the first time, really, in the Andy Farrell era. So Tadhg Furlong is world class. He's playing. James Ryan is back fit and playing well and in form. Caelan Doris is back after a very interrupted start to his Ireland career. And Johnny Sexton is fit and in form. And that's like four players who you would have an argument about them getting in whatever international team they played for. Certainly, maybe Sexton at his age probably doesn't make the All Blacks team. But the rest of them are like, these players are good enough to play for anybody in the world. It's world class. And when they're fit and fully there, there's a tone set by their presence. Andrew Porter also played brilliantly and he's fully fit. It's just like, for the first time, he's got a full deck. And it looks like the attacking influence of Mike Catt is beginning to show some.
Eventually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like these things, we're trying to change the style. It's like, oh, you can just flick a switch and the players will all be able to do it. Mm-hmm. You can't.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out we can offload when you ask your players to offload and you drill them and drill them and drill them and drill them.
Or were Japan just terrible?
Japan were also just terrible.
So like what sort of prep is this for the All Blacks?
Ireland are minus 10.
Yeah, I think it was actually, I think it was more the last time I heard, so maybe it's coming a little bit, well, but is that a fair enough?
Yeah, that's like, we're always 10 points against the All Blacks, and sometimes it's 16. I think it was 16 in Chicago, pretty sure it was. And then it would have been 12 after we beat them there. We beat them by 20 points and the spread came in by about 4 points for the next week.
Mm.
And I think they might have, maybe they didn't cover it, but they certainly beat us.
What a weekend for our sport.
Yeah, I think you gotta be happy with that. But we'll get into this a bit more later on. You know, no one's getting carried away by winning the first of a November series. All of a sudden, the game against the All Blacks looks pretty tasty.
Mm.
160 quid a ticket.
As in,
that's what it is.
But you can still get a ticket.
No, it was 160 for the premium, 120 for the plebs.
So which was harder to get a ticket for, Portugal or the All Blacks?
That's a good question. I'd say you could get All Blacks tickets. They were released twice.
Okay.
On general sale.
That's interesting. So you had two shots at it anyway.
Yeah. I think with Portugal, they went straight away, right?
Mm. They were gone in about 15 minutes now. I'm speculating, but yeah, they went really quickly.
All right. 7 minutes past eight this morning, OTBAM, brought to you by Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. That's this week's performance rankings.
OTBAM's performance rankings with Gillette.
We're talking Premier League with Daniel Harris next.
OTBAM.
9 minutes past eight this morning. Delighted to say Daniel Harris is with us. Daniel, good morning to you. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Hi, everyone.
So, is it purgatory? Is that the position we're in now with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, where the end is not quite in sight? We don't know when it's going to come, but it's definitely coming. It's never going to be good again, and yet we have to live on.
Yeah, I think the end will be quite soon now. I wouldn't be particularly surprised if it came before the end of the international break, because it's just an obvious time to do it. And I don't think that United can really afford to go out of the Champions League, and that's a problem in that a win over Young Boys in the last Champions League game, even if they lose in Villarreal, might not be enough. It's only enough if Villarreal don't lose to Atalanta. And they definitely won't want to lose the money for that, given that they could be staring at no Champions League next season. And as usually when it comes to these kinds of things, it is the money that makes the people make the decisions in the end.
I was making the case that actually the most important result of the weekend wasn't just the 2-0, but it was the fact that West Ham are now viable contenders for a Champions League spot, and even Arsenal's scratchy 1-0 win yesterday puts them back in contention for a top four spot. At the start of the year, we all assumed that the top four was baked in because of the money and the investment and the quality of the squads, but actually what West Ham have done and what Arsenal have done is just jimmy a little bit of doubt into the mind of the hierarchy at Manchester United, who are like, oh, We thought it was guaranteed we were going to be top four, and it's not anymore.
Right, but I think the reason why it's guaranteed, why it's not guaranteed, isn't particularly because Arsenal and West Ham are playing well at the moment. It's because United have a lot of good players, and a sensible performance with this squad would get United into the top four. And whatever the, whoever it was, if United were failing as miserably as they are, and the reason why the United top four is in jeopardy for United is because United are failing. It's not because Arsenal and West Ham are playing well. Someone's got to be fourth. So there would always be some level of rivalry for that spot because someone's going to be in it. And there'll always be some teams that are accumulating points. But I don't think that it's particularly because of the threat from these clubs, because if it wasn't them, it'd be Leicester or whoever, it'd be someone else. So it's more that United, it's not, it gets to a point, and you see it with Van Gaal, you saw it with Moyes, you saw it with Mourinho, it gets to a point where not only are they doing badly with the squad or not well enough with the squad, but they're at the point where it's not possible to do any worse with the squad given the quality of the players. And at that point, you think that almost anyone could get more out of this squad than Ole is doing because it isn't possible to get less out of it, and you can't sustain that for long.
On that though, Dan, so like whoever is going to be lined up for this Manchester United job, there are the upsides and the downside. Massive upside, which we don't really need to get into here. The downsides are actually not too small, though, if you ask me. So you have a situation where he has to deal with too many players basically in the squad who think they should be playing or should be playing. He has to deal with Ronaldo and he has to deal with Pogba. And when I say he has to deal with Ronaldo, that might sound ridiculous because Ronaldo's actually done very well. But the Ronaldo situation, since he's come in, Man United have been just poor, basically, almost week in, week out. And then you have the Pogba situation. So you have these two massive names as a coach that you just have to deal with. What am I going to do here?
It's a hard job. I mean, I wouldn't... Being manager of Man United, being manager of any football team is a hard job. Being manager of Manchester United is a hard job and you have to take hard decisions. I mean, I wouldn't, if I was looking for problems, Ronaldo wouldn't be the first or the second or the third of them. Without Ronaldo, United would be in an even worse nick than they are.
Would they though?
Because, yeah, of course they would. Cavani's never available. If you had another centre forward who was always fit and always scoring goals, that might be slightly different. But the team isn't functioning properly. The reason why they're playing badly at the moment isn't Ronaldo doesn't press. United weren't a pressing team before Ronaldo, and anyone that says that, you wonder if they ever watched United before Ronaldo, because they didn't do it. They didn't press before Ronaldo. Ronaldo is rescuing terrible performances. And if you had, imagine if you had, rather than saying what is Ronaldo doing to this team, imagine if you had Ronaldo in front of a team that is functioning. Then that should be the case. And Ronaldo is not the ideal centre forward anymore, but it's the inability to defend properly is causing them problems here. Like against City, City played really well, obviously, but United conceded an own goal, and that one at the back post, where two defenders let a ball come from one side of the box to the other, and the goalkeeper gets beaten by a poke at his near post. I mean, that's not Ronaldo's fault. And the reason why you get that is it's not infrequently you would see that, where a team is under the cosh for a long time, and the goals that they eventually concede are pathetic little goals like the ones United conceded at the weekend, because minds are frazzled, players are tired, players are nervous. Like the goal at the end of the first half, United spent 47 minutes or whatever it was chasing the ball. So to see that happen at the end is not unusual. But the reasons for that are the defending isn't good enough and the midfield's not working well. They just got into shape. They weren't trying. They couldn't get out. They couldn't find an out ball. I wouldn't blame that on Ronaldo, even if I would like my front three to terrorise the opposition back four when they're in possession. That does seem to be like the ideal way of playing football, but it's not the only way of playing football. It's not the only way of beating Manchester City, because United have been doing it the last few seasons. But it's also worth pointing out that they've been much better away from home than at home. They haven't, apart from that game right before Corona, where they won 2-0, they haven't beaten City at home much, but they've done quite well away. And ultimately, that sort of reflects where the two teams are. The City are a dominant team, and United are a team that struggle to control the ball. Although those two wins that they got most recently at City were probably their two best performances under Solskjaer. But the team isn't functioning properly. And to pin all that on one of the only people that's doing what they're meant to be doing, okay, which is Ronaldo, they bought him to score goals. He's scoring goals. That's what they thought he was going to do. And the guy that would be playing centre forward if he wasn't there is not available half the time. Then, yeah, that's not where I'd start.
Can I put it to you a different way? Since Ronaldo has come in, and again, I'm not really blaming Ronaldo for this, because I don't think he himself could have done much more. Since Ronaldo has come in, what other outfield player has played well for Man United consistently?
Almost none of them, but...
Why?
Right, but that why would I blame Eric Bailly scoring an own goal the other day, or the fact that Luke Shaw and Harry Maguire have come back from the Euros, and they're not the only England players who this is true, I don't think, and they're all over the place. How could I possibly blame that on Ronaldo? What's that got to do with it? Like, Harry Maguire has perpetrated some, like, against, I mean, I know he wasn't properly fit, but against Leicester and against Liverpool, two of the worst performances I've ever seen from a Manchester United player in 38 years I've been watching him play. Now, I can't blame that on Ronaldo. It would be really easy if that was a simple solution, because then you say, well, fine, don't pick Ronaldo because he's making your defenders perform like they've totally forgotten how to defend. They've totally lost all composure. They've lost all game intelligence. They've lost everything. Just get rid of him and then it will be all brilliant. Like, leave Ronaldo out. But what happened when Ronaldo didn't play against Everton? It was still crap. Like, so how can I blame it? Is he doing it from the bench?
It's more so the attacking players, though. Like, they don't, you know, we were sort of speculating, like, Ronaldo coming into the dressing room would just be, it'd be such a kind of a cool thing for those strikers to say, like, I can learn from Ronaldo. And, I mean, the malaise at the back, you're absolutely right. I think there probably are some hang-ups from the Euros, whatever. But the other strikers or the other attacking players, when you think of Cavani and Ronaldo against Spurs, for example, they kind of did dovetail well against an insipid Spurs. But other than that, since Ronaldo has come in, there doesn't really seem to be much cohesion in attacking areas either, for whatever reason.
One of the problems is that, and this is a problem with Ole, is that something happens, then he changes the formation, moves a few players around, but it's usually still the same players that he likes. It doesn't work. That's what's been going on this season. Then he tries something else, but he sort of tried it before. And he can't find a formula that works at the moment, because he's like a balding man trying to, like, rearrange his hair so it doesn't look like he's bald. So he'll, they went with five at the back against City, which more or less, to me, just looked like to try and make sure they didn't get an absolute hiding like they did against Liverpool, because safety in numbers at the back. So because of safety in numbers at the back, it means he can only pick two strikers, and that means he's got to leave out some really good players, which wasn't how he wanted to play. And because the midfield can't dominate the ball, it means he's got to play Fred and McTominay, which means he's got to leave out a creative midfield player, whether it's Pogba or whether it's Van der Beek. He can't play one of them. And just the problem is that you take a bit from here and you have to move it and put it over there, and then the place where you took it from looks bare. I mean, Rashford's come back from injury and he scored some goals very quickly. I don't think it's so much that the strikers aren't in form or the strikers are playing badly. Greenwood's had some really good moments as well. It's the fact that United don't dominate the ball enough to allow the attacking players to sustain the attacks, to get them enough good ball in enough good areas. So what happens is they might make a chance, even against Liverpool, where they got whacked 5-0. They made two or three brilliant chances because they got really good players. But the problem then is that Liverpool dominated the game for a period where United just couldn't stop throwing them in. And by the time they next got it down the other end, the game was basically over. Against City, they couldn't get any decent possession for their attacking players. And that's not because there's no cohesion with the attacking players necessarily. It's because no one's quite sure what they're meant to be doing. The message that's being given on the training ground and in the meetings either is a wrong message, a bad message, it's not getting through. And then you put that with the fact that a lot of the players are just playing very badly at the same time. And it's all of those things. I'm not sitting here. It'd be ridiculous to sit here and say the reason United are doing badly is because Mason Greenwood's out of form. Because ultimately, if you don't give a striker any service, then they're going to struggle, and they will. They still managed to produce moments. I mean, we saw it against Atalanta. They managed to produce enough moments to get out of that game with a point, even though they, on the balance of play, didn't deserve a point. Against Liverpool, they made a few moments, because you always get the ball for a little bit of time in a football match. But in order to sustain good form, you can't get by with so little of the ball and so little quality possession that United have been having. And to start, the problem isn't that the strikers aren't playing well, although it would be good if United could get one of them into the team. And the problem is that the whole way that they're playing isn't working. And within that system, whatever that system is meant to be, it's constantly getting changed. There's no time given for anything to settle. If you look at the best teams, City, they play 4-3-3 basically every game. Liverpool, they played a bit of 4-4-2 last season, but only when things started going badly, they play 4-3-3 every game. Chelsea play that 5-3-2-1 pretty much everyone called it, 3-4-1-2, 3-4-2-1. They basically play the same way in every game. They might have a few other ways that they can change to if a game circumstance depends on it, but they play the same way. And what that happens when that happens is that you have the same personnel, more or less, you change one or two, playing the same way. And that's how you build the cohesion that you were talking about just before. You partly build it. I mean, some managers want to say, when the ball's over here, you stand here and you stand here and you stand there. And some managers like to do it like that. But there's the main way, I think, from speaking to a couple of the coaches, that builds cohesion is just doing it. Is doing it on the training ground, but also doing it in matches. And United aren't able to do that because they're changing personnel from every game, they're changing formation from every game, and you don't build up the confidence in where your teammates are going to be, and you don't build up the cohesion that enables you to produce dominant football and great moves around the box on a regular without having that form that to fall back on, the fact that you know what how it's going to be, and also that you then. The other thing that's wrong that I was saying before is that the way that the team is built, the structure of the team isn't working. And that's another thing that keeps changing. And it's partly keeps changing because the instructions on the training ground aren't coming over. And it's also changing just because the players themselves, no players are really playing well enough to stay in. But a lot of them are getting to stay in because Ole doesn't trust the alternatives either. But ultimately, this is what happens when a manager runs out of ideas and runs out of road. That's what we're seeing. I mean, we've seen it before with loads of clubs. We saw it with Moyes. We saw it with Van Gaal. We saw it with Mourinho. The other three all got much longer than they should have done. With Moyes, it was over way before he got fired after Everton. With Van Gaal, it was over at Stoke in the league over Christmas, but he made it to the cup final. With Mourinho, it was over with Sevilla, and he made it to the start of the next season. They didn't back him in the market, and then he managed to get through to November. With Ole, it's a little bit different, I think, because the season is still there now. The quality of the teams in the league, the rest of the teams, is high enough so that the teams at the top aren't too far away, and United is in the Champions League. So the financial decision that makes sense seems to me to be you have to act now. So that's why I think it'll happen now.
Well,
but
I would agree with
that. This is what it looks like with any team when it's over.
The only thing is, right, unless you actually have somebody who is a replacement, what's the point in acting now versus letting Solskjaer take you to the end of the season? I mean,
what I said before, it's not possible for it to be worse than this. So even if you fired Ole and then appointed Ole as caretaker, it'll probably get better. But it can't be worse than this, right? And United have two games coming up in the next month, Villarreal and Young Boys, that if they win them, it means a lot of money. And if they lose them, I can't even say the words. I can't imagine what another season watching United in the Europa League would be like. That's some of the most unbearable football you'll ever see. But it's the saving that money or earning that money and also that prestige. Because what happens, right? If you get another season in the Europa League, you've got players who are aggravated. You've got players that start thinking, well, actually, this isn't the place for me. Makes it much harder to... the confidence in the club isn't good. It's harder to qualify for next season's Champions League. It's harder to sign players. And it's harder to keep the circle of money going around between the TV companies, United, and the Glazers' pockets. And all of those things contribute to the decision that needs to be made, and it needs to be made now. No one's happy. No one I know who has any concern for United is happy that this decision is going to be made. Let's be real. I think most people that hate United don't want this decision to be made either. It's so glaring, this decision that needs to be made. And what can you do?
Well, so a caretaker manager for the rest of the season then, and you wait and try and get a world-class manager in the summer? Or what's the good outcome?
Depends. So I guess the shortlist probably is Zidane, who it doesn't look like he wants it. And to me, I don't think he would be the right choice at all. But it's very different. This is a good squad, a really good squad, but it's imbalanced. It's not a squad that has one of the greatest midfields of all time, has Ramos and Varane and Marcelo, and has Benzema, Ronaldo up front. I mean, it's not that level of squad, but it is a good squad. I don't think Zidane would want it. The name, I mean, I haven't put this out there because I haven't substantiated it, but the name I keep hearing is Brendan Rodgers. I imagine the advantage of Brendan Rodgers is that he would take the job now if they offered it to him. Probably, if he was going to take it, he'd take it mid-season. He would. I think he's good. I think I've said on here, I thought he was a brilliant appointment for Leicester because I know at that level, Brendan Rodgers is really good. I don't know. I have any a Scooby at best if Brendan Rodgers has the personality to come at United and compete with Tuchel, Guardiola and Klopp to outsmart those guys over the course
That's
of the
interesting.
Season.
So like you think he could, you don't think he kind of showed at Liverpool that he can be a world-class coach at a team that can challenge and potentially...
He did an amazing job at Liverpool in that one season, but And it's not necessarily a but. He did have, maybe it was a lot to do with him, I don't know. He had Luis Suarez, who no one knew quite how good he was, and then it was like, oh, he's that good. And that might have had a lot to do with Brendan Rodgers, the way he juggled the front line, Sturridge, Suarez, Sterling, and moved them around in positionally, whether one week it'd be Suarez on the right and next week it'd be Suarez in the middle. He did an amazing job at doing that. We never take that away from him. It was brilliant. But he did it for one season, and he didn't. His defences have never massively filled me with confidence, and that is definitely something you need at United. And also just the personalities that it takes to succeed at United. I mean, I don't know what's right and what's wrong here, because the guys who've had some success, Matt Busby, Alex Ferguson, obviously, then Tommy Doherty and Ron Atkinson, all consuming, big, dominant personalities. I mean, Mourinho and Van Gaal had that as well, and they failed. So having that it's not a rule that if you have that, you'll succeed at United. I don't see the charisma and the presence from the kind of managers that succeed from Brendan Rodgers. It doesn't mean there aren't other ways to succeed, because managers...
Brendan Rodgers thinks he's got the charisma, and in many cases that's all that's important, Dan. It's like he believes it.
Yeah, he's got to make... Right, but the difference is, can you make other people believe it? Like Busby, people say, like, when Busby walks into a room, you notice, and not because you're seeing the glare from the lights onto his Newtons. I don't know. And that's... Brendan Rodgers has that kind of thing. Is it artifice, or is there substance to it?
If you poll Man United fans, Daniel, on Rodgers, how do they vote?
I don't know. Like, I imagine, I'm guessing, because, and I, maybe I'm guessing just because this is what I think, not sure, pluses and minuses. And this is even... pluses and minuses. I mean, you can tell he's a good coach. The Leicester team he has play really good football. They've got loads of really good players, but Leicester were brilliant at signing players before Rodgers was there, so don't know how much exactly that is to do with him. I mean, I'm sure it's something to do with him, but you couldn't be sure. They're not doing particularly well at the moment. That's probably something to do with him. But they've got a lot of injuries. That's nothing to do with him. So you look at it like that. I think for me, I would definitely get rid of Ole. I would have got rid of... I mean, the thing is United, because Villa and Norwich obviously fired the managers immediately we get into the international break, because it was something they thought they were going to have to do. And I read the other day, United, they were so staked all in on Ole that they didn't think it would come to this. And I see that because one of the things that's stunning about this is how crap it's got, how fast. Like, we all knew that this season was make or break for Ole. If he can't do anything good, then he's got enough good players and enough of a good squad to at least get closer to the league title than he did last season, to compete a bit more, even if it's not to win it. No one thought would fall apart this quickly, but anyone who's watched United must have known that there were certain things to look out for, that if they don't improve this season, then they're never going to get better. Because while it's always been getting better from sixth to third to second, the same problems have been persisting. So the warning signs were there very early on in the season. Even the game they whacked Newcastle in, they didn't play well. The Southampton game, the game's right at the beginning of the season. The people that make the decision should have been watching that, thinking, OK, well, we need to keep an eye on this. Then the Leicester performance... It was not possible after Leicester, after Villarreal. The performances in those games were so bad, the young boys, where you knew that that was it. So even if it took them until Leicester to say this isn't going to work, there's no excuse post-Leicester for not knowing that it was over.
This hasn't been said enough, though, either. He should never have gotten the job. And this was clear at the time. I know that they've made high-profile appointments since Ferguson that didn't go well, but there was nothing in his CV whatsoever. Just like Frank Lampard, to me, it was absolutely irrelevant that they had this connection with the club. For a job of that stature, Ole's CV, he'd already done enough to suggest he wasn't a great manager anyway. He should never have gotten the job, and those who clamoured for him to get the job because he made a good start don't understand football, if you ask me.
I was happy for him to get the job at that point, so you have to file me under the list of non-football understanders.
I wouldn't do that.
No, that's absolutely fine. I mean, it's not a situation where you're like, well, this bloke is definitely the bloke, but he's earned the job by actually doing the job, which is more than a lot of other people would be able to say.
In how many games, though?
Right, but then you see how it goes. I don't think the reason he got the job as caretaker at the time was because there wasn't anyone else available who they were certain would come in and do a job. And so you've got a bloke who's doing the job. There's a buzz around the club. Now, they could have waited till the end of the season, for sure, because then obviously after he got the job, it all fell apart quite quickly. But like, but then they did give him the job. And it wasn't just because he played for United. Obviously, he got the manager as care, he got the job as caretaker because he played for United. But for me, one of the reasons I was happy, and I wrote a piece about this, so you can all go back and either and laugh at me and read the piece that I wrote. But he was someone who I had thought, and there is evidence of this, and I'm not saying it to make myself look good because you probably think it makes me look like a moron. But when Moyes got the job, the day that Moyes got the job, the United website asked me what I thought. And I said, I thought that was a terrible appointment because I knew enough about Moyes to know that he didn't have what it takes. And someone who I had thought would be a good manager, and it was a totally fantasy appointment, as I said, was I'd be interested to see how Ole did it because he was someone who I found really interesting in the way he talked about football. I'd watched quite a bit of footage of him managing at Mulder where the relationship he had with the players and his bravery to do things differently. Like when he first took the job at Mulder, they had a striker, their leading scorer. He fired him because he managed him out, whatever, sold him because he wasn't suitable for the kind of football he wanted to play. And hearing the players who played for him talk about him made me think that he had some skills that were very, very useful for management. Now, what has turned out is that the other skills you need for management, like not just the man management skills, like the, I think there's probably an element of toughness. I think at the beginning he was ruthless. He hasn't and got rid of Lukaku, got rid of Fellaini very quickly. Hasn't been ruthless enough subsequently, but also probably hasn't surrounded himself with people who are good enough. Like Alex Ferguson was good at lots of stuff, but he was always trying to get people who could help him do the stuff he wasn't good at. Ole obviously did that.
That's such a key point. People don't talk about that. It's all Solskjaer.
His coaching has become a hot button topic over the coaches around him over the last month or so. So look, sorry to because we need to move on a little bit. But if Brendan Rodgers turns it down now, what else is what is the opportunity? So you mentioned Villa and you mentioned Norwich and they've pulled the plug. If Man United pull the plug tomorrow and there's a week back and forth with Brendan Rodgers and he decides actually you know what I'm going to stick it out. What happens then?
If Brendan Rodgers wants the job, he's not sticking it out. Like Celtic were like on for the treble with 9 in a row. He didn't stick that out because he got a better job. Brendan Rodgers is ruthless when it comes to Brendan Rodgers, and I didn't say that particularly. I can't believe I even said that. Like Brendan Rodgers would say it, but there we are. Maybe he's growing on me. But if Brendan Rodgers, he might not want the job. He might think I'm really happy at Leicester, or he might think I reckon I'm getting Guardiola's job, so I'm going to stick here. He might think that. And if he does think that, then obviously he's going to stay. But if Brendan Rodgers wants to be manager of United, he thinks, I'm not getting this opportunity again, then Brendan Rodgers will take the job.
Okay, but let's assume City...
If they offer it to him.
Yeah, let's
I don't know what happened.
Okay. If it's not Rodgers, what happens then? Is there somebody in the club who could take on the... Is Michael Carrick the caretaker manager for the rest of the year?
It's never Michael Carrick. No, because Michael Carrick is
just the caretaker, though. Like, even to get you to the end of the season.
If anyone who's at the club is probably Darren Fletcher... Who's funnily enough, someone else I've looked at, and Ander Herrera is the other one, players who I think are brilliant talking about football and seem to understand the game really well and really good communicators. The players I've just watched and thought, I bet you'd be. Right.
Herrera's a ready made coach.
That's what you want to do. But obviously it's ridiculous because we've seen you need these people aren't ready. You need to be special in order to manage Man United. But if it was anyone at the club, it would probably be Darren Fletcher. I don't think it would be that, but if it does have to be someone like that, then you get through to the end of the season, hope it gets better, and then you're looking, I guess, the people they'd be looking at are Ten Hag and Pochettino, depending on what happens to them and what happens in the whole mad world of football between now and then, because strange things happen. But it does seem like, oh, they can't carry on like this, because ultimately the Glazers' money depends on it not carrying on like this. There's no reason to think it's not going to carry on like this. And so usually when that happens, people do something about it.
So on balance, you think it's likely to happen before the remaining two games in the Champions League to try and make sure that those remaining two games in the Champions League result in qualification for the next stage? And
I'm guessing, yeah. But yeah, that would make sense according to the course of dealing that we've seen over the last 15 years, yeah.
Okay, rapid, quick-fire, 30-second answers to these ones then, please.
30-second answers. That sounds like a long time.
How good are City?
Good, very good.
And
do you want more? 30 seconds on how good
City? Come on, that's...
What would Brendan Rodgers say?
I would say City's best. City's top level is the best in the league. But there's a reason why the team that have been top, that Chelsea are top, is because they're solid. The most solid team are top, and I think that's because now the teams below the top ones have so many good players that can hurt you, that not conceding a goal and relying on your quality players to find one might be better than having a dodgy defence, but you could keep the ball and you don't have a centre forward. But City's best is the best in the league. Might not be enough to win the league, though.
How serious do we need to take West Ham?
They're a good team. They're not going to win the league, but they're a threat for top four. Don't know what happens because they've got a relatively small squad. So if Declan Rice gets injured, or if Mikel Antonio doesn't play for a long time, then obviously they don't have replacements anywhere near good enough. But momentum and confidence obviously are quite helpful. I think there are probably studies that show that, in fact, momentum's not that helpful. In fact, you just think that it is. But yeah, they're a good team.
Is Stevie G ready for Villa?
Ready for... No idea. He's someone who's weird. He's someone I didn't think would be a good manager, particularly because on the pitch he didn't play like he didn't. He played with his heart. He was a Royal Rovers player. He wasn't someone who controlled the game, who astounded you with his football brain. He just had that ability to impose his amazing talent and skill on games at big moments, rather than someone who conducted them. Didn't sound great talking about football particularly either, but did a great job at Rangers. In parentheses, after Brendan Rodgers left. If Brendan Rodgers had stayed, who knows, maybe he wouldn't have done as well. But I guess the thing with Gerrard is what you get with him is the players will probably want to play for him in the first place. And I'm sure that if you're a footballer, a well done from Steven Gerrard means a hell of a lot.
I totally agree with that. I thought the same with Gerrard. Can I ask, are Liverpool title contenders the way they're defending at the moment?
Yeah, because one of the reasons United are almost not out of the title race is because of that point I made before, why Chelsea are top. The teams below the top are so good with so many good players that it might be a relatively low points tally that wins the league this season, which means that you can have some bad games and stay in touch. So, I mean, as I said, Chelsea are the most solid, City are the best, Liverpool's still really good. I don't think it'll be Liverpool, I think it'll be one of the other two, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was Liverpool.
Arsene Wenger has said in a new documentary that's out on Amazon that he should have walked when the Kroenke era began around 07-08. This is really interesting because the whole world now looks at this and goes, yeah, we knew at the time. And you stuck it out for another half a decade and really tarnished his legacy with Arsenal fans. When Wenger's name comes up, it's not just the warmth of the Invincibles.
Anyone who supports Arsenal that thinks that Arsene Wenger's legacy is tarnished, it is a twat. I don't really know what else to say. Arsene Wenger rebuilt that club. When Arsene Wenger took that job, Arsenal was synonymous with boring football and just drabness. And Arsene Wenger came in and he revolutionised that. He produced some of the best football we've ever seen. The rivalry with United was the greatest sport that I've ever seen in my life. And he hung on too long because football's a hell of a drug. He loved Arsenal. He loved the buzz. He loved the drug. You respect that. And even at the end, he still won a couple of the FA Cups. Arsenal probably quite fancy a couple of the FA Cups now. And look at how much the struggles of all the people that come after him when he was getting them into the top four every season. People thought that wasn't good enough when they were paying for a new ground. The new ground's not great. That is maybe a black mark. Like maybe he could have done more to make the new ground less crap. But otherwise, he kept them relatively competitive for a long time, and the struggles that everyone who's come after him has had to keep them competitive says to me, not that he tarnished his legacy, says that he did some pretty good work there.
All right, we leave it there. Daniel, good stuff. Thanks a million.
See you again. Have a good day, everyone.
Daniel Harris giving us his thoughts on some of the big stories from the weekend and the fact that Brendan Rodgers is the name that's being whispered around the place.
Brendan Rodgers was mentioned more than anyone there, which Brendan Rodgers would be delighted about in terms of the Brendan Rodgers references. But Daniel's great value, yeah. It is like, you know, there's a lot of looking back and retrospects and all that, but he shouldn't have gotten the job, let's be honest. Like, he shouldn't, and I think a lot of people said that here at the time. Maybe,
but you understand why it makes sense in football. It's like it was a shield.
It was because they've been doing so badly, I think, prior to that. But since it was like, why don't we try this? Because he's an ex-legend. He probably understands the club. He will invest, I think, in young players.
And he did, and he got rid of a lot of the dead wood. And so the next manager who comes in is going to have quite a lot to work with. Like, really only needs one or two bits to make the whole sum much better. If you've got two good central midfielders, all of a sudden that team looks much better.
Yeah, that's not straightforward though,
hard if your scouting is good.
Yeah, but also in fairness, as Daniel referenced there, their defence for whatever reason has become really bad, and like, I don't want to be blaming everything on Ronaldo, because I think it was just when Ronaldo came in, it was going to create issues in some shape or form.
I'm not buying that Ronaldo causes... He's not the Jenga piece that causes everything to go wrong. I think the Jenga piece is that there's been a loss of form from Maguire, an injury, and Varane was always injury prone. Mm. He's never played more than 20 league games over the last 5 or 6 seasons, so that's what you were going to get from him. And to decide that, okay, this is going to fix our defensive problems, wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
You know, and
Liverpool are probably lucky we're not kind of looking at them as much today, because their last two performances against Brighton and West Ham, in which they've conceded 5 goals,
have
been probably a bit alarming. Now they've serious injury issues as well in terms of their midfield. Is Van Dijk playing as well as he has been? Is Alisson playing as well as he was?
The injury problems that they had last year were like the ones that caused them, and therefore, do you know what I mean? It's always, there's always something.
Mm.
It's always an excuse. Oh, the centre backs were injured last year, and that's why we were completely crap. It's like,
well, they have a lot of midfield injuries at the moment.
They do, but you're buy some players, invest in the summer.
Yeah, it's
plan for the eventuality that you might get some injuries in sport.
Mm.
No,
they probably thought they'd be able to get away with it. At the moment,
like, did they get away with it last year? They did not. They fluked their way into the Champions League. That's what I think.
I wouldn't say that. Like, obviously Van Dijk is Van Dijk, but Van Dijk's performances since he came back, which isn't amazing because he had a serious injury, he's not the player he was at the moment.
I think he'll come good.
He may well. But Alisson as well doesn't inspire me with confidence as much as maybe he used to.
It's making for a very interesting title race.
We just have something to talk about all the time. And if you run a sports station that's 24/7 sports, Ollie at the wheel helps.
I thought that atmosphere was great. When you can hear the away fans chanting in favour of the current
manager. Anyone
who
wants, like, you cannot have games of that.
At the wheel.
Yeah.
Ollie's at the wheel. No.
Yeah, but you can't have games of that importance at 12:30 on a Saturday. Like, people.
What is the atmosphere going to be like on Thursday night?
I've been talking about this. Like,
are there going to be pro Ronaldo Man United chants? It better not be.
The Irish football, the crowd that goes to Irish football games is always quite interesting. And it's a mixture of sort of like, I don't know, I think everyone's more or less pro-Kinney apart from 10 or 15% who maybe are still harbouring doubts. But I think everyone in Lansdowne now wants to believe in a young set of players that are up against it in games of this nature. But, you know, are a new Ireland. And, like, you know, you look at these new kids coming through, some of them from very different backgrounds, some of them from all parts of the country. Kildare, league slip. Amoba Medeli to me is, like, could be the coolest thing that's happened to us in a long time outfield anyway. And yeah, it's like, it's a cool team. They lifted the nation against Serbia despite the fact that we were battered for 75 minutes.
I think his ceiling is like captaining a top 4 team in the Premier League. You could see him as the captain of Chelsea or United at some point.
Van Dijk's replacement.
Like, at some point in the next 4 or 5 years, you know, he's 24, 25, reaching that point where it's like, ooh, look at this guy. 80 international caps.
We'll get to the papers now. There's an article with Rudy Vata, there's an article about his son Rocco Vata, and like he's just talking his son up to a degree that you're slightly worried about. So
very,
I don't want to.
Very un-Irish.
It's very un-Irish, and he's from Albania. I don't want to talk him over Medele up to the extent you're saying he could captain a top 14.
He could,
but right at this moment, because of his age, of course he could. I'm not sure. Maybe Rocco would be a fan of what his dad said.
He said he could be as good as Ronaldo.
Yeah, it's like, why not?
He could be the Irish Ronaldo.
Well, he kind of said he could. He essentially said he's done more at this age than Ronaldo did at that age. I was like, yeah.
So Rocco plays for Ireland.
Rocco plays for Ireland. Like, this is, it has been talked about a little bit, but it's absolutely mad that, like, our 17s team recently had 3 players whose dads were Albanian, if not their mums. And in 2 cases, I think Kevin Zeffie, totally Albanian heritage, they came over to Ireland. Still slightly worried about Zeffie definitely committing to Ireland longer term, even though I think he will. But, like, his family are all decamping to Milan now, and he's basically leaving Ireland for the foreseeable. So hopefully when he comes back to all the camps, he's still loved.
For the Luxembourg game?
Yeah. Like, seriously, we need to tie these players down, because Zeffie's an interesting one. But 3 players. Albania is a tiny country. I think it's like 2.5 million. I can't say, and I've, you know, I've come across all sorts of people from different nationalities who've come to Ireland. I've very rarely met any Albanians in this country. Maybe there are lots of Albanians in Ireland. Three seriously good Albanian kind of heritage Irish and Albanian players in the 17s team, and one of them is the intriguing Rocco Vata.
Right, well, we'll do a bit of digging and find out a bit more about him and maybe get Rudy on. Obviously a Celtic legend. player in his time.
I don't remember that much from him. I remember the name, and like I never really followed the SPL that much, but he obviously wasn't bad. He was apparently signed on the basis of a performance that he produced against Ireland for Albania.
Yeah, I think I remember that part of the
were they the Hoxha days, or was he gone at that stage?
Which?
Enver Hoxha, because he talks about this in the piece where it's like, I left a dictatorship, like I left a place where you couldn't speak freely.
Oh god, I don't know.
Enver Hoxha, he was the guy who brought in all the bunkers because he was really paranoid about Albania being like bombed from above, and there was like a bunker for every four Albanians, which now a lot of the kids use basically to have their first snog, stuff like that. Okay. Albania is an interesting place.
There you go. OTBAM with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. Michael Verney, good morning to you. How are you?
How's it going, lads?
A very interesting weekend of GAA action. And I want to start with Nace. I think what Nace have done here is very dangerous for the managers who like to go from town to town and county to county and rack up a slew of titles and whatever else comes with that, because they got rid of their manager after the quarterfinals and have now won their first title since 1990. This is a big story, I think.
A dangerous precedent may have been set. Yeah, it's a phenomenal achievement, really. Paul Kelly was managing the side up until I think the week before the semi final, and then there's various theories about what happened in the background, but there was some sort of a hoo ha, and the manager resigned, and Owen Doyle and Eamon Callaghan took the reins. We're both still playing, players, managers, whichever you like it, co-managers, and they managed to get over the line, as you say, for the first time in 31 years. It's absolutely unbelievable. Like, Eamon Callaghan was captain. He just said yesterday, I never thought this day would come. His nickname is Leper. He turns 39 next Friday, and he's a county final winning captain and a county final winning joint manager as well. And then Owen Doyle said after that it was his greatest day in football. This is Owen Doyle, who's still kicking football for Kildare and was picking the team and no doubt leaving off some of his friends and picking some of his friends. And the nature of it, that they had to leave any loyalties aside for the best for Nace, and they managed to get over the line against a Sarsfield side who would have a lot more tradition than them recently. It's a phenomenal achievement, yeah. And as you say, it might force clubs to maybe rethink maybe dishing out sizable amounts of money to managers from outside, maybe who aren't getting results or who have been on the kind of managerial merry-go-round. But it's a massive, massive achievement for them. And I'm sure, like, I don't know if you saw the scenes in St. Connacht's Park after, like, the vast majority of Nace must have been on the pitch after. It was phenomenal. The pitch was nearly covered in Nace people.
And that's the thing, Joe. Why has Nace been? I know they've had great success at underage in recent years, and I would be friendly with Niall Cronin from Racing, who was involved in that, and he felt that they had like this massive underage talent coming through, and he was involved with the seniors, but it may take a bit of time. But why a town like Nace would it have such a barren 30 years? Is it one of these? And there are towns around the country where they're the townies. They don't commit to it like we do in the rural areas. Like, why would it be 30 years?
I don't know, but I'd say the rest of Kildare is very concerned that Nace might have finally got shit together, because the Hurlers have been dominant in recent years and very progressive and taking the underage teams out of the Kildare scene to get them better as well. So we'll see if Nace becomes a juggernaut. They may well, and look, you'd have to hope that this has some kind of knock on impact at inter-county level, but I do think you can't trust the goddamn players. That has long been the narrative, and it turns out maybe when you trust the players and you listen to them, they might know best.
Yeah, I can't see the two boys being joint managers now next year from the start of the season, because it probably fell very well for them in the sense that they just had to take the reins for, well, God only knows how long they'll go on in Leinster, but most of, you know, what they wanted to have in place was in place. All the hard training was done. All that S&C work was done, and they were in a good position. They were in a good position going into the semi-final anyway, and the lads managed to keep the train on the tracks very well too. It's just it's interesting too, you just say about Nace. Nace is a massive hurling stronghold within Kildare, and I suppose Newbridge would be seen as the the kind of football capital at the moment anyway, just given Moorfield's dominance and even Sarsfield's dominance over the last 15 or 20 years. But maybe that will break over the next while now. It's a huge, huge success for them.
Yeah, and big catchment area and plenty pick for them as well. So, let's move on because we want to talk about Ballyhale. And Colin Fenley confirmed, I think what people probably knew was that he'd finished as an intercounty hurler afterwards, that he's going to stay hurling with the club after they won yesterday. Was this expected or is it a bit of news?
No, to be fair, I do think it was expected. When you take a year out from intercounty hurling in your early 30s, it's highly likely that you will not be getting back involved. Even the same with Stephen O'Keefe in Waterford, who took a year out last year. I think he was only late 20s. It's very, very difficult to take a year out at that age and come back in. Obviously, we don't know if there's any mitigating circumstances or anything going on in the background for why he took that year out, but he seems happy with his decision yesterday. Interestingly enough, like, Ballyhale are that good that Colin Fenley was held very, very well by Tony Forrest yesterday, and Owen Cody was held very, very well. Neither scored from play. They still clocked up 3.19 with an array of other players chipping in. They're a phenomenal machine, and even it's a long way away, I suppose, at this stage, but they're already heavy favourites to win the Club All-Ireland again. That was a fourth Kilkenny in a row. They had done back-to-back All-Ireland titles before last year. They obviously didn't get a chance to do it last year. So to be going for a three in a row, it would be a hat-trick, but it would be 3 in 4 years, but it would still be 3 in a row. They're a phenomenal machine. Like, James O'Connor came in and replaced Henry Shefflin. One of the most, unenviable tasks you could imagine in the GAA, coming into a team back-to-back All-Ireland winners. And he was able to, as I say, no more than the lads in Nace, he was able to keep the focus on winning, able to keep the focus on, there's more in us. This is a golden generation. And now this will be his first crack at Leinster and maybe a first crack at All-Ireland as well. So there's no stopping them anytime soon. And just new faces coming in. Ronan Corker, brilliant yesterday. Brian Cody, brilliant. Joey Cuddihy. TJ was brilliant, obviously, but he has more lads chipping in around him now. And it's a fair statement that Owen Cody and Colin Fenley could be held, and they can still clock up 3.19 and win probably pulling up at the end, because O'Loughlin's threw absolutely everything at them. And in fairness to O'Loughlin's, they were up 3 points at half time. Probably deserved to be a bit more up. Ballyhale hit 2 goals early in the third quarter, and O'Loughlin still managed to be up at the third quarter. And one of the big talking points from yesterday would have been Kilkenny defender Paddy Deegan, who's been playing the forwards all year with O'Loughlin's. I don't think he ever played there before until this year. He ended up with 2-3 for them yesterday and was absolutely outstanding from start to finish, and took the fight to Ballyhale from start to finish. And it'd just be interesting to see, will be that be something that Brian Cody will look with, or will he be back cornerback again next year?
Is he, where would he play in the forwards for Kilkenny? What kind of role would he have?
He could play in the inside line and come out, but I would say he'd probably be best as a half forward. He's phenomenally fit, phenomenally energetic, really, really good work rate. Probably your stereotypical half forward in the modern game now, I would say. He'd be able to get up and down the channels. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Cody's interest in him as a forward was kind of peaked yesterday, because he was brilliant. And he has an eye for goals as well. And he mightn't look the most natural forward, but he just gets the job done. And this isn't just the county final yesterday. This is a common team across the whole championship. He's been one of the better forwards in the championship. So
right.
Colin Fenley stepping out, and he was obviously gone last year. Maybe Paddy Deegan could end up in the forward line. It was another O'Loughlin's player yesterday, Conor Heary at wing back. He could be another one that Brian Cody would be interested in. A big, powerful wing back. I believe he was in the cadets the last couple of years and couldn't even commit 100% at club level. But I think he has most of his hard training done, and I would be a bit surprised to see him around the Kilkenny squad either next year.
All right, that's maybe what you need to be up to if you're going to be trying to go up against those Limerick lads. A bit of cadet training wouldn't go amiss for everybody. Kilmacud Crokes remain on course for a Dublin double. Paul Mannion was good again. The big what if hanging over Paul Mannion is he going to come back and play intercounty football again? Everybody's kind of almost blah blah blah. Yeah, it's definitely going to happen. It looks like he would be able to step straight back in.
Yeah, he's been one of the best club footballers in Dublin this year. Kicked 4 points at the weekend, 2 from play, 2 from frees. He doesn't look like physically he's lost anything at all. He still looks that really, really powerful force. And Dublin just can't afford to have players like that not involved. He obviously didn't see that much game time in 2020, and I don't know if that was part of the reason why he stepped aside. But you'd imagine there's a lot of conversations happening behind closed doors now, with maybe with Jack McCaffrey, maybe with Paul Mannion as well. Paul Mannion definitely looked like he hasn't skipped the beat at all. And Croke's on course for the double. No one from the two starting 15s I can see actually involved in both starting teams. And there may be some among the squads as well. But they were brilliant against Coolah the week before in the hurling. And they were brilliant at the weekend again against Ballywood. No one would have foreseen them winning as handily as they did. And on the other side, they're playing a St. Jude side that they haven't got over the line. They've been in around semi-finals and finals a lot in the last decade or so. And they have an influx of players from up the country, like Pat Spillane Jr., son of the great Pat. He was man of the match the other night. I think he kicked 3 points. Dave Mannix from Austin Stacks. He would have looked at his own Austin Stacks side, his native Austin Stacks side, booking their place in the semi-final at the weekend in Kerry. And then he books his place in a county final with St. Jude's. And they've Niall Coakley from Cork and many other guys from the country as well. It seems to be the place for all the Colchis to go if they want to kick football in the capital. But they've got a serious squad put together now, and that's going to be a really interesting final.
I mean, that's long been a good tactic to bolster your numbers, hasn't it, to get the Colchis come and play for you. Is Pat Spillane Jr. good enough to play inter-county? Is he at that level after a performance like that, or is he kind of not at that stage of his career that would have happened years ago?
Just reading some kind of comment from a lot of locals in Kerry, say that he's really, really trimmed up, and you know, he's really progressed an awful lot since he came to Jude's compared to when he was playing with Temple Noe. He obviously won a junior All-Ireland with Temple Noe. I'd say he's probably a few years off, and the fact that if he's based in Dublin, probably wouldn't make it particularly easy to be committing to Kerry at the moment. But it just shows the massive conveyor belt that they have, even if they haven't really got it together properly at senior level to be winning All-Irelands yet. When you have players like that going and shining in other counties, it can't be a bad thing. And I'm sure he'll relocate back down to Temple Noe and Kerry in the coming years, and he'll definitely be an option for them anyway, and one of many options.
Let's talk about Malky O'Rourke, because he was involved at the weekend in the Derry Senior Football Championship. Glenn beat Schlochneil. I think everybody's familiar with the Schlochneil story. Malky O'Rourke has put together an absolutely brilliant coaching CV.
Yeah, amazing. In fairness, Ger, he was with his native Fermanagh. He was brilliant. He was brilliant with them. They progressed through the divisions in the league, moved on to Monaghan. He really, really established them as, a bona fide Division One team, a team that was, in the top five or six every year, won a couple of Ulster titles. They're obviously very close to getting to an All-Ireland final as well when Tyrone defeated him by a point in 2018. Now he's gone back into the club game, and you kind of think, these guys that step off the inter-county treadmill, they don't disappear. They're always back involved with clubs and usually doing some really, really good work. And Malky got the Watty Grahams, the Glen, over the line yesterday. And they were it was a comprehensive defeat of a Schlochneil side who have, been challenging for All-Ireland honours in recent years. And yeah, he's a massive CV. And you'd imagine it's only a matter of time before he comes back in. Maybe he could end up back in Monaghan again, or he could end up back in Fermanagh again. But guys like that, I'd imagine Malky O'Rourke's phone is always buzzing in the wintertime with someone trying to get his services. And, that was a big win for them. And interestingly enough, a side effect of that for Schlochneil probably means that their concentrations are solely focused on the Ulster Hurling Championship now. And they've been very, very close to getting to an All-Ireland final in recent years as well. So one door kind of closes, but I'd say probably another one is open for Schlochneil.
All right, the Ulster Football Championship's looking like it's going to be pretty tasty. You've got Scotstown Gaels, that's Rory Began, and St Eunan's, both in having won at the weekend as well.
Yeah, Ulster is unbelievably competitive. You say, Glenn, after winning, their first Derry title in a long time, that, they'll be in the mix in Ulster. And then you think of Scotstown, Rory Began, and, the Hugheses and many, many more. They're seasoned veterans at Ulster level. St Eunan's Letterkenny, obviously. They did the double as well. They won the hurling the week before and they won the football yesterday. Not the most aesthetically pleasing game against Naev Conlon, very, very defensive, but they won quite handily enough. And that, you know, no more than the Ulster Football Championship at county level, at club level, the provincial championship up in Ulster is going to be massively, massively.
This game was on the box, wasn't it, Michael?
Yeah,
I had friends in my WhatsApp group just saying, like, I think they were having a bit of banter with Eamon McGee on Twitter. Is like, this is a joke. Like, how can you play like this for 55 minutes?
Yeah, it was a hard watch now, in fairness. And that came directly after, you know, a 3:19 to 3:15 thriller in Kilkenny. And, you know, that's why I would always say that, you know, even a bad hurling match, I think, is an awful lot easier to watch than a good football match at times. But that definitely wasn't a good advertisement. Imagine, it's just, you can't get your scheduling right the whole time. But if Naas, or even if the Meath final between Wolf Tones and Dunboyne, which Wolf Tones won by a goal, what on TV, it probably would have been a better advertisement for the game. But
St. Eunan's hurling county final in Donegal was probably more entertaining than the Donegal county football final, is that fair to say?
There's my argument, Johnny. Yes. even if it was a poor standard, I would say it was better. But yeah, listen, sometimes it's just a matter of getting over the line at this stage anyway. And people would always say, up in Donegal, I know Jim McGuinness said in his book, conditions often dictate the way that football is played. When the Atlantic Ocean is beating in off you and there's usually a wind blowing in your face, you usually have to try and play a sort of possession game where you hold on to the ball. But whether that means you put as many people behind the ball defensively as those teams did, I'm not sure. But
the one counter to that would be obviously the county of Kerry, where obviously it never rains and it's never windy. It's not mountainy whatsoever.
Just, and all they want to do is kick the ball, yeah, and that's all they do. Yeah, in fairness, yeah, no, that's a fair point.
Last one is Mullan Yachta are back. The Giant Killers, who were one of the romantic stories of the club championship a couple of years back, they're ready to go again.
Yeah, the miracle of Mullan Yachta, that was probably more than the Mead ladies this year. I'd say that was the story of the GA year in 2018. Just unbelievable scenes. When they beat Crokes in that Leinster final in Tullamore, just brilliant for a half parish. And interestingly, the other half of the parish was playing in the Cavan final yesterday. So Gauna, which is the other half of the Mullan Yachta parish, they drew against Ramry United in the Cavan final yesterday. And by all accounts, the Mullan Yachta lads would be celebrating in Gauna. That's where they celebrate. So I don't know if Gauna was kind of, if half of it was kind of quiet and half of it was full of Mullan Yachta people last night. But it's interesting. Mickey Graham was obviously the messiah when they won the Ulster in 2018. And he's back involved in a coaching capacity with Mullan Yachta. So the split season does allow clubs to get some really, really good inter-county coaches and managers potentially involved in the club season once the county season finishes. So he had the magic touch with them a couple of years ago and he's back involved in a coaching capacity under the manager, Kieran Fox. And that's not the only Cavan connection. Keane Mackey, who won county titles with Castle Rattan in 2018 and 2019, he's going out with a Mullan Yachta girl, sister of the two Rogers brothers that are playing from Mullan Yachta, and he's actually living down there now. So he transferred in 2020 and he was man of the match yesterday, kicking 2 points and was kind of really pulling the strings for them as right. well. So there's plenty of Cavan connections there. They're right on the border, but they could go on a run again. They were impressive yesterday. Played a Mostrom side that hadn't been in the county final since the last won it in 92, but they went about their business really, really professionally. And so it's going to be interesting to see maybe if Crokes win in Dublin, they'll get a shot at revenge at some stage at Mullan Yachta in Leinster.
All right, we'll wait and see. Michael, good stuff. Thanks a million. Cheers.
Cheers, George. Cheers, Johnny.
It's Michael Verney with a roundup of the weekend's GAA stories. If you want to get in touch with us this morning, 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number, or you can leave a comment on the YouTube stream. OTBAM with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. Loads of comments coming through. Manchester United are a shambles, says Steve. If he's not sacked this morning, there should be protests outside the stadium targeted at the board. In fairness to Ole, he can't sack himself. Well, obviously he could resign, but he isn't going to. County finals and the return of crowds should be included in this week's rankings. In the green, I presume, says Shane.
Yeah.
Barbalazza said it was time for Dean Smith to go. 5 wins in 30 is not acceptable. He was really liked by fans and we wanted him to succeed as a fan, but it wasn't working anymore. E-Digit.com says, the way they're going now, no way we'll get into the top 4. But that's not true.
Man United.
Yeah.
No, they wouldn't though. By the way,
if they continue, but if they replace the manager.
I think that's what he means, I think, with Solskjaer at the helm. And as Daniel said as well, it's quite a competitive league, which is good. Like, you don't expect, there aren't these rollovers week in, week out. And Manchester United at the moment, you wouldn't really be confident about them beating anyone in the league.
No. The results have been terrible against, like, it turns out, bad teams,
and they're not even actually playing well. Like, there are so many flaws in the way that they're playing that they're, you know, they're actually probably fortunate in the Atlanta games that they got like 4 points.
Greenwood and Rashford are shocking at tracking back too, says Philip. That's coaching. That's them being told your job is to do this. If Jurgen Klopp was in charge, the two lads would be really good at tracking and pressing, because they would be coached in it day in, day out. They'd be drilled, this is what you're supposed to do. Shane says, great content, lads. Cheers me right up for Monday morning. Glad to have you with us, Shane.
Did he mean that in a kind of an ironic way, or?
Who knows?
He's a Man United fan.
Jared says, something that struck me on Saturday was the factions of United fans singing against each other. Usually you hear home and away fans trying to drown each other out. At Old Trafford, it was pro-Ole and anti-Ole.
Yeah, that was interesting after the game. I was trying to detect, there were definitely fairly audible boos. But I don't know, who goes to Man United games? I know from the experience of Liverpool games, you get an awful lot of day trippers. So, like, you know, the hardcore fans, are they pro Ole? Because at this stage, I think you got to be realistic as well.
I don't think anybody. I think they're gonna sing him out because they know the end is near, and he is a club legend, and you know, centrally involved in key moments in turning the club into the super club they are right now, but no longer the right man for this job.
And just on Ronaldo as well, I know Daniel said it's not his fault, but like, look at Ronaldo when he's not in the box. Like, he doesn't really have anything to offer anymore. Like, and that's a massive.
He's being asked to do something though.
Well, I think he's had more headers in his own box than the opposition box since he joined Man United. Which should not be the case. Obviously.
Useful at set pieces, both ends of the field. That's a contribution.
Ronaldo's performance against Ireland was where he's at the moment. Like, he was that unbelievable 2 moments of quality, but he was awful for 89 minutes because he's obviously just not able to dictate play like from quarterback positions or whatever anymore, because he doesn't have the legs and that's not his game.
Right.
I don't know, the Ronaldo thing fascinates me, because I know you can say Ronaldo himself is doing very well, but since he's come in, for whatever reason, Man United have been pretty crap.
Because Manchester United don't have a plan for him.
They
don't actually have a plan.
He started the 3 games in a week, 3 massive games against Liverpool, Spurs, Man City, Man United, and he started them all. At his age, it's like, ugh.
That's desperation, isn't it? Right, here's what's coming up on OTB Sports Radio today. Our James McLean interview is OTB Gold at 1 o'clock. State of the Union, Keith Wood at 3. The classic is The Brawl. That's our documentary series. The Brawl is Meath and Mayo in the 90s. Declan Murphy is OTB Gold. His book, Centaur, talking about being kicked by a horse in the head and having to regrow his life. And then the lads are back live from 7 o'clock tonight with Off the Ball. OTB Sports are partnering with Science Week to ask what challenges are important to us and how science might help. Visit scienceweek.ie to share your ideas and find out about the events taking place throughout Science Week 2021. During this ad break, you'll see a sneak peek of one of our Science Week videos focusing on the evolution of safety features in F1. Up next this morning on OTB AM, we're talking rugby with Alan Quinlan and Fiona Hayes.
OTB AM.
All right, it's 9 minutes past 9 this morning, and we would love to hear from you. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number if you want to get in touch that way, or of course you can leave a comment on the YouTube stream. Returning to Ireland's very comprehensive victory against Japan, and I'm delighted to say Fiona Hayes and Alan Quinlan are with us this morning. Fiona, I might start with you in terms of what your expectations were ahead of the Japan game. Did you think it was going to be that easy? Are we to read too much into it? Should we be very happy? What's your level of excitement?
Yeah, I suppose after the game I was really excited about the performance and the change in, I suppose, attacking style. We saw an absolutely high tempo, high paced attacking style, lots of options, great running lines. So it was exciting view for me to watch, because I wasn't really expecting that from Ireland. I was probably expecting it a bit more from Japan. So it was absolutely clinical performance. And in the open space, the offloading game was absolutely brilliant. You definitely can get excited about it, but I don't think it was probably Japan's best day. didn't have the ball, but defensively I thought they were quite soft in tackling, and we will definitely not be getting that when we face the All Blacks next week.
No, it was a nice little run out as opposed to something too taxing, and so far we're still waiting for any significant injury news, but it looks like, fingers crossed, mostly Ireland have come through unscathed, which I think, Alan, is kind of an underrated part of the whole era so far, that there hasn't been many occasions when the Ireland's management team have had the opportunity to pick their best players at the same time. So we had fully fit Tadhg Furlong, we had fully fit and playing well James Ryan, we had Caelan Dorris, and we had Sexton, all starting a match and all actually in good health for the first time, I think, in the Andy Farrell era.
Sure, I think you having some continuity towards next week is what's really important. They played really well, as Fiona said. A lot of positives in the game. The one negative, probably the few lineouts they lost in that second half, and that'll be probably a bit different next week. But give them credit for what they did on Saturday, the way they attacked, and all those players played really well. Look at Furlong charging up the middle of the field, offloading to Porter. Was it a little bit too easy? Probably, but they created that tempo and intensity in the game that blew Japan away. And Sexton was really good, Gibson Park, because of what the forwards did, you know. So there's a lot of options there. And you mentioned James Ryan, you know, his form a couple of years ago, the way he kind of shot onto the scene, and with Leinster and Ireland, he was phenomenal. Looked a little bit tired last year, had a few bangs and knocks, and having him fit and well leading the forward charge is really, really important as well. So loads of positives. And the obvious question is, where, you know, what will happen next week and what will it be like? But certainly the continuity they got out of that game and the way they were able to piece things together was very, very beneficial for them as a team.
Yeah. Fiona, do you pick the same team next week or do you make some changes? What would you do?
Yeah, I think you have to reward the guys that went out there and did their job. I mean, there was, as Quinny said, there was in the second half, there was a couple of line-out kind of issues at times. But like, you know, and I know I've spoken in the past about Heron. He gives you that at set piece. He's obviously going to be an option there. But I mean, Kelleher in the open play and just his physicality, his carries, everything. It would be very harsh to drop him after that performance. You know, you don't obviously always blame the hooker. But you know, in general, I just thought that team deserves to get a crack at the All Blacks next week. I wouldn't be making any changes on their performance. Clean bill of health. Everybody's in positive mind space. You know, they're excited after that game. They came away really feeling like they've played well. And I think you'd be going in really positive for next week's game. And I would certainly be sticking with that team. I thought the combinations worked well in the centre as well. Ringrose and Aki. Conway on the wing was absolutely outstanding. You know, Lowe especially has been criticised in the last few games for Ireland he's playing. He obviously dropped, worked on his defence. We didn't really get to see that much in the game. But I mean, he was just amazing, running amazing attacking lines. We saw a different style of Ireland. He was running those lines maybe 10 metres out from our own try line, and he was making 20 metres off the pitch. So it was exciting rugby, and I think they definitely deserve to keep their places and have a crack at the All Blacks next.
Does Gibson Park start for you then?
Yeah, the tempo. I'm obviously a big Murray fan, a Munster woman, with the absolute tempo he brought to that game. And as Quinny had said as well, it was the clean out work. The ball was on a play for him to move it, but he was just really, really clinical. And for me, there was a slight drop in tempo and pace when Murray came on. I understand there was other changes around the park, but it was really exciting to see the tempo and pace that he brought. And it was something I was waiting to see in an Ireland attack for a long time.
Yeah. Quinny, what about that? Would you, for the big game, do you bring Murray back, or actually do you go with the guy who pulled the strings and played really well in Gibson Park?
Yeah, you go with Gibson Park because he produced a performance on Saturday that was really clinical. Look, at the end of the day, and the halfback Sexton and Gibson Park were really good, but it was down to what the forwards did and the accuracy around the breakdown. I think Paul O'Connell is, without me sounding too biased, and favourable to what he, you know, my connection with Paul, I think the players have come out and said it themselves that he's brought a real kind of detail and focus on the kind of breakdown work that Joe Schmidt had implemented a couple of years ago. A lot of the same players who played under Joe, so you could argue and say, well, these guys should be doing it anyway. But it's amazing when you're out in a training field And the main man who put so much effort, so much time and focus in on the accuracy around the breakdown, everyone's role, he left. And, you know, you don't get the same emphasis on that. And it might be just a couple of percent off. And we've seen Ireland being quite sloppy in the breakdown. And if you want to play any sort of attacking rugby, if your breakdown ball is quick and your accuracy is there and it's aggressive, it makes a huge difference. So I think Paul, probably being in the group and working under Joe and obviously having his own beliefs around the breakdown, has brought that focus back in there. So it's going to be different next week, and that's the reality. We can, you know, people have asked me in the last couple of days, were Japan bad or were Ireland really good? And I kind of get a little bit frustrated by that, because we're afraid to give them the credit. They've taken a fair wallop. And from what I saw on Saturday, Ireland were brilliant. Is it going to be different next week? 100%. You know, I actually feared that Japan could even come close to beating us on Saturday. So you win 60 points to 5. Let's just give them the credit for that. I don't think they're going to get carried away. Is it a bad thing that they won so easily when you've got a really incredibly talented, powerful team coming next week? Well, I don't know. We'll wait and see. But Gibson Park was really good, and I think the ball was presented. The challenge for him next week is you'll have Retallick, Whitelock, Artie Savea, possibly Sam Kane, Papalihi, these guys hounding Ireland around the breakdown, and that's up to the Irish pack to try and make sure that they have some decent ball next week. It's not going to be as quick, it's not going to be as free flowing, and they're probably going to have to kick a little bit more Ireland and play territorially as well. So, but what we saw on Saturday was very good, and Gibson Park was central to that.
Ger was saying as well, just sorry that the MyCat influence is taking time. Like, from your perspective, for somebody like him who's trying to implement those ideas, like, is it a long process? And like, did the Japan game show that it's maybe being evinced in performances now?
Yeah, we saw it towards the end of the Six Nations, Johnny, and I think what was really effective under the Joe Schmidt era was the pressure, the kicking game, making no mistakes, playing in the opposition half, all that stuff. And it brought incredible success. So a lot of these players were kind of programmed into that system. And when you have a team, the game evolves all the time. Year after year, people are trying to find new ideas, new ways of breaking down the opposition. Everyone has a defensive structure that it's intriguing trying to break it down all the time. And if your ball is slow, you have to kick sometimes. You make mistakes in your own half. You give away penalties, teams kick points, you lose games. I think Ireland were caught in the middle of trying to add some attack to their game, but they dropped the levels with the kicking game, the kicking chase, all that kind of stuff. Their defensive efforts weren't as good under Joe. So trying to evolve that is probably taking a little bit of time. It's hard to know. When you play Japan and you have so much space and time, and Fiona did say it, and I'm sure when they review the game, the Japanese, they'll be very disappointed with some of their alignment. Ireland exposed them and found little pockets and holes everywhere throughout the field. So the attack, as I said, going back to what I said, Six Nations, they were brilliant against Ireland. We saw loads of width in the game, loose forwards out in the touchline, variety in the way they ran. So it's taken time, but we're starting to see it now. Yeah. But
Fiona, the
next
other thing
is going to be a challenge to kind of attack in the same
way. Fiona, that was the
thing
afterwards as well, that Andy Farrell was talking about. You lads in the media, I'm sure, will write about the points we scored, but by a country mile, the best part of our performance was our defence. And this is the great unknown. We can give them credit for keeping Japan to 5 points, but obviously, I mean, if we keep New Zealand to 5 points, we'd be pretty happy. We would expect New Zealand to score between 20 and 30 points next week, and it's about making sure that that's on the low side.
Yeah, it's that. It's looking at their form, and we know that New Zealand can score tries from anywhere. We know what they bring. I mean, I'm sure they've reviewed the last few games that they've played. They've seen them playing, and they're playing that high tempo. And I think for me personally, the first half especially, we didn't see enough. We weren't able to judge that Irish defence because Japan barely had the ball. We were so clinical. Even Conway retrieving the ball in the area, Hugo Keenan on our kicks. We just, everything seemed to work out for us. But I think defensively in the second half. We saw a bit more from Ireland, and their line speed, their alignment, everything looked on point. And I like Japan, as we spoke about before, had the ability to tack from anywhere, and they would know that going in there, but they seemed to be able to cover that at all aspects of the game. Second half, we saw it a little bit more.
There was some sense that we might have used the Japan game as room to experiment, but that clearly wasn't what happened. What happened with the Japan game was he picked his first team, and it looks like he's got a very clear sense of what his first team is now, and I think we all know what his first team is now as well from that perspective, Fiona. How important is that, that actually this is how we're going to play, this is who's going to play when they're fit, and if you want to take that jersey, you're going to have to be absolutely sensational in form for your club or even for your country when you get a few minutes?
Yeah, that's it. And I think that's the way to go in that kind of camp environment and team environment. I mean, we were talking, you know, about that hooker spot for a little while. We didn't know who was going to take control. It was going between a couple of guys. You'd Heffernan in there as well at some stage. So I think he's kind of laid the marker down, and he said, these are the guys that are in form. These are the guys that are starting. They've put in their performance, and we'll see it with selection for the game against the All Blacks. That is, if he goes with something similar, the same team, this is what he's thinking. And I think they all seem to really play well off each other. I had a few questions, like obviously the back row, there's so much there, you know, there's going to be able to say, like the talent up at camp, you didn't know where he was going. And I think he's found the right back three. I personally think Ty Byrne in second row, the threat he can bring from second row is really, really positive. And having him in the second row as well as a loose back three as well is going to be really, really positive for Ireland, and especially in this game. And the All Blacks will see a mountain of work against a very, very exceptional All Black back row.
Yeah, Alan, talk to us a little bit about that, specifically the back row, and what having Doris at 6 versus Doris at 8, is there a significant difference in what impact he can have in the game?
Not really. I think he's a very intelligent player. Someone makes a tackle, bounces back up, ready for a poach. He brings just a real kind of presence about himself and a real good footballer. He's balanced. So he didn't have his biggest game in the second half. I think he had 10 carries or something in the first half. They were all on the front foot, lots of options and lots of players jumping up, touching the ball and stuff like that. But I just think Doris is a really intelligent footballer, and being able to read the game. And this is something I've always believed. If you can get as many players on the field who are naturally good readers of the game, well, that adds to your attack and adds to what you're trying to do, and people anticipation, people making line breaks and stuff like that. So he's incredibly athletic. And then Jack Conan, I think he's, you know, showed he probably went to a different level in that lines series, you know, started the 3 tests, and that's only better, brilliant for Ireland. So it's very hard to say put Doris back 8 and start switching Conan. I think Conan deserves and earned the right now to you know, to have that jersey and hold on to it. And he showed on Saturday how good he can be again, and his quality. Having Doris in the team just offers you that more footballing ability in the back row. So the two of them are 6 and 8 at the moment. And Van der Fleer was very good as well. He's offering something different in attack, the way he's carrying the ball. So I don't anticipate any changes. There is loads of competition there, and players will try and put pressure on him, but I think there's a really good balance to that back row at the moment.
And Tadhg Byrne as a second row, there was a fear a couple of seasons ago that he wouldn't actually make it at international level as a second row just on the pure basis of size and bulk, but actually it turns out that he's more than capable of playing. That's the way it seems. Next weekend will be the final judge on that, but we shouldn't have any concerns about that, right?
Sometimes I think, yeah, he's such a good player that if Doris wasn't there, I'd be saying put Ty Byrne at 6 and bring Henderson into the second row. Henderson brings a size and a physicality as well that maybe sometimes we need. And, you know, Ty Byrne isn't the biggest second row in the world. He's still 6'5" and he's very athletic, but Henderson's a little bit of grunt, and he offers a little bit more of that. Sometimes Ty Byrne, because maybe of the back row, he gets, you know, he's trying to get his hands in the ball more than what he's doing defensively. He's brilliant at the breakdown, so he's a wonderful player. And I think, look, having him on the field and offers a lot to Ireland in their attacking game, because attack isn't just about getting the ball to your wingers. It's about all the forwards, what they do, the lines of running, timing, all that kind of stuff. And he's been brilliant, Tadhg Byrne. So it's a tricky decision for him next week. I think Byrne and James Ryan will start. But it's a lot of positive stuff here this morning. But at the end of the day, next Monday morning, if it's still going to be a very difficult game for Ireland to win, but we'll be able to pick holes. And if they do get a result, it'll be brilliant. But it's a totally different challenge, and we could be critical of some of these combinations next week.
Okay, so we need to wait and get the full evidence. I guess, Fiona, should we point it out that New Zealand are 10-point favourites against Ireland next week? This is us coming off the back of a 55-point victory. Italy were reasonable for 15-20 minutes against the All Blacks, kept them scoreless, and then capitulated and got beaten by nearly 40 points. And obviously they hammered Wales the previous week as well. So it's not like the All Blacks, it's not like we're catching them at a low ebb or anything here.
No, I know they're in flying form, and you know they've played a lot of rugby. They've had their the games against Australia, South Africa as well. So that's been flowing. They look really good. The Italian game, as we said, the first 15-20 minutes, but I don't think the All Blacks had the foot in full throttle. So I think they were more kind of looking at things and playing around. But this All Blacks team, I mean, we talk about players, you talk about Whitelock, you talk about Ritalik. But when they're not playing, sometimes you wouldn't even notice it if Ardie Sevilla isn't there, because the guys that come in are just as good and just as strong, and their squad depth is absolutely immense.
What kind of a game do you expect Ireland to play then, Fiona, on the back of what we've seen? Keane Tracy in the back of the Indo is pointing out 7 box kicks but 18 offloads, and I think it was 15 in the first half. The obviously conditions in the second half slowed things down a bit. Do we do the same thing? Do we play the new game style, new game plan, and irrespective of whether or not it means we get beaten by 30 points, try and bed this in against top quality opposition? Or what happens? What do you expect?
Yeah, I think they're going to stick with that offloading game. I mean, it worked really well. As I said, the Japanese weren't physical around that kind of defensive area, so they were able to get their hands free. But I thought technically they carried the ball different. I thought they were always looking to get their hands free, two hands on the ball. And Ireland have obviously worked a little bit on that. I do think there will be more of a kicking game, but it will be far more strategic, because we can't obviously give the back three of New Zealand constantly ball to be running at us. So I think it was the tester this week, but I think it's going to be a very, very similar game plan, and it's kind of a new attacking system. They've talked, Andy Farrell has talked about his defensive system, they back that. So I reckon they're going to go all out and really kind of test their offloading ability against this physically strong, dominant All Blacks team, and obviously have a lot of options off set piece. I think Porter was excellent in the loose. I thought he scrummaged really well. I mean, he maybe gave away one penalty, so he might be a little bit disappointed at that. But I think if we can get that set piece completely nailed, we'll really, really give the All Blacks something. And if you can hold them for 50-60 minutes, you're definitely in with a race, because that hasn't been happening to them. They've been pulling away in most games, and I think they're very comfortable in that position. So if you can keep them in that kind of battle, definitely up with a chance.
Alan, I don't know what to make from Wales' performances. They really put it up to the Springboks at the weekend. Springboks have obviously had some success recently against the All Blacks. They got absolutely annihilated by the All Blacks the previous week. So what's the truth about where the All Black form is, and can we use Wales as any kind of indicator?
I take some positives, because I think we're probably... But Wales missing so many players, bar some silly mistakes, the intercepts, they were kind of in touching distance with 15 minutes to go. And that's the challenge anytime you play New Zealand. It's that last 20 minutes, they change gears, and it's something they really focus on, playing for the kind of full 80, even if there's a couple of minutes to go. We saw them do that in the Rugby Championship as well, over the summer, that, you know, they can just... 2 minutes to go on a game, they can score 3 tries. They just have this ability straight from the kickoff, go again. And you've got to find a way to stop that pace that they can put in the game. You know, whether it's Mwanga that starts or Barrett at 10, that attack is just sensational, scintillating at times. And it's about controlling the tempo of the game. And if you can do that, we have a template that we did it before in 18 and then in Chicago as well. So I think the approach needs to be a mixture for next weekend. You try and get into the opposition half, and if you get an opportunity or a chance, take your points with a penalty, and you might get one or two chances in the game to score tries, and you've got to be clinical. If somebody makes a line break, there has to be a bit of anticipation and people on their shoulders. So if we're to win this game or be anywhere close to winning it, Ireland have got to really play for 80 minutes and be so focused, because they can cut you apart like they've always been able to do.
Yeah.
If you allow them play, they've always been able to do this. So it's no surprise or shock to us that this is what can potentially happen if you stand off them a little bit.
Well, hopefully Andy Farrell's point about the defence holds true, and next week we're talking about a great defensive stand from Ireland. Thanks to both you, Fiona and Alan, for joining us this morning, and we'll get you back next week to see exactly how things went. It's 9:31 this morning. How confident are you feeling about an Ireland victory as a seasoned rugby watcher at this point, Johnny?
Yeah, well, the 10 points line is the one that interests me. So are they, do we know more? Do we think Ireland are better than they were this time last week because they beat Japan 65?
I think they've committed to a change of style. That's important. That is genuinely important. It's the same conversation.
More offloads, less kicking.
It's the same conversation we've been having about the football team. Mm. Like, this change of style and evolution is going to, and needs the opportunity to bet in. And let's see at the end of the whole the COVID nonsense what actually happens when they've got supporters back in the stadium and they've got their best players fit.
What's Andy Farrell's approval rating from fans?
That's a good question. I'd say before the Six Nations last year and just at the start of the Six Nations, it was bad. And then fans being fickle, you beat England, it's like, wow, this is great. So I'd say it's pretty high. I mean, I actually do think Andy Farrell connects with Irish people in a very specific way. He's a gruff Northerner.
He's a Northern Englishman. Yeah. Northern Englishman is very Irish in many ways.
Well, this is my point.
Yeah.
Now, a more working class background than rugby would traditionally be associated with. It's an interesting little thing to tease around the margins of, but I certainly think he's doing a good job.
He seems a likeable bloke.
Seems like a good fella.
So who's more likely to take a bit of a batter in, the football team or the rugby team?
This week on Thursday and Saturday, two world class teams roll into town. It could go horrifically badly for both teams.
Mm.
And yet just a little part of you thinks that Men in Black moment of being a sports fan is like, yeah, we could do this. So I don't know, honestly. I don't know what's the spread, what is in the football, is it fairly similar?
They'd be expected to win by probably a goal and change, I suppose, if you want to look at it that way. But I don't think a draw would be... Kenny's a great man for getting his players to believe that they are actually capable of causing problems against the exalted opposition. And in the case of Portugal, they are, I think. The problem is, it's different playing at home than it is to playing in Faro when, you know, there's no expectation really that you're going to get anything out of the game and you can sit back. Whereas, like, let's be honest, for the Serbia game, like, our midfielders were running around, like, just running after the ball, and they were all legless really by the end. And that will be a challenge because Portugal have the players to pass us to death.
Ireland are 8-1 to win the football against Portugal.
Which is fair enough. Actually, there are parallels in the two games in terms of the expectation. The opposition team is very much expected to win, but it wouldn't be amazing if they didn't. And some crack now if you're able to go to both games. It'd be the old place will be heaving.
And Ireland are 3-1, 130 to win the rugby. So much better chance of winning the rugby than we have of winning the football, according to the bookmakers.
But obviously the draw isn't a big player in rugby, whereas it's a big player in the football. So the prospect of us... Portugal will be similar odds to New Zealand-ish, put it that way.
I think Portugal are 3-1 on.
And New Zealand will be much the same.
I'm going to tell you exactly what they would be. 9-2 on.
Okay, so New Zealand are slightly stronger favourites. But right. Yeah, it'll be Thursday will be a really seismic moment, and the older you get, you forget about this. Like, and I was at the Galway United match yesterday. I went back to the old stand where I watched Galway United growing up, and I was loaded with nostalgia about watching games and seeing people like chanting like songs that would have been me when I was like a kid and so on. They're the kids of today. But for a lot of people, this is their chance to see Ronaldo play. And that is their chance. And for a lot of kids, I know my nephew Finian would love to see Ronaldo play. And his dad is like, how can I get him to see this game? Because he wants to see Ronaldo. He's a big Man United fan. And even for me, I've never seen Ronaldo play. So for a lot of people, this is their chance to see Ronaldo play. And then you add in the...
Ideally, we break his hearts the way he broke our hearts in,
yeah,
in Pharaoh.
Yeah, and he acts like a petulant child at the end, which is so, you know, Ronaldo.
We want the full thing.
Yeah, we want Immobile Modele to have him in his pocket and possibly bang in a header at the last minute, let go by Ronaldo.
Ronaldo getting red carded the way he should have been in several games this season for Man United.
Absolutely. Oh, that petulance is there, and does Kenny tell them to engage in a little bit of the dark arts?
Oh, yeah.
Dundalk were well able for a bit of that in the day.
Right.
It's going to be crack.
9:36 this morning, OTBAM with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. Okay. Tomorrow morning, we're looking forward to Ireland-Portugal, and we're going to catch up with Ronan O'Gara as well. We have a ton of NFL goodness coming your way this week with the return of OTB Club Gridiron. It'll have highlights from the snap, reports from games, early bird tickets to events and more. Signed up now at otbsports.com/clubgridiron. The snap is also back, and that's brought to you in association with Aer Lingus College Football Classic, Northwestern versus Nebraska at the Aviva on Saturday the 27th of August 2022. Check out the website at collegefootballireland.com for more details. Tickets about to go on sale for that, so you want to pay attention to it. Owen Sheehan is in the US. He's going to be back on OTBAM tomorrow to tell us about what he's been up to. He's been speaking with the Minister of State for Sport and the Gaeltacht, Jack Chambers, about college football and bidding for the 2030 Football World Cup.
Okay, I'm here with Jack Chambers at Northwestern University. Jack, obviously you're here in your capacity as Minister for Sport, but this is about so much more than sport, isn't it? The connection between Ireland and the United States through the prism of the College Football Classic.
Yeah, no, we're really positive that we've this five-year series, and obviously it's one match, and we hope we've Northwestern and Nebraska coming next summer, next August. But it is about so much more, and engaging and seeing the huge support and the appetite amongst the American community here in the Midwest to travel, to participate in so many activities around the game, the academic opportunities and the cultural connections between Ireland and the US, sporting connections as well. So it is about one, it is one game, but there's so many more opportunities for the two countries to build those strong links that are there, and it's great to see that going to happen now over a 5-year cycle, and this huge economic benefits for Ireland, and to embed those connections.
When you're here in your role in the United States, what's the most common theme when it comes to the curiosity that Americans have about the economic opportunities that Ireland produces at the moment?
Well, Americans, so many of the Americans I've engaged with have, they might be employers, or they've huge connections to Ireland as it is, both in Dublin or in the regions, and are employing many people. They see Ireland as an outward-looking, positive about trade, importance being in the European Union, but also the huge cultural connections between the two countries, and how Ireland really embraces sport, the Irish fans as well, supporting so many different sports, and embracing college football as has happened in the past. So I think for sport, for business, for, you know, just embedding those economic connections and those cultural connections between the two countries, people are really excited about that in the US that I've spoken to over the last day or so, and I think there's many people here looking forward to travelling to Dublin, but also across the country next summer. They're talking as well about the Ryder Cup in 2027, so the opportunities are there for tourism and for just building that connection between the two countries, particularly as we exit from COVID. A lot of Americans haven't got to travel over the last year or so, and I think many are looking forward to getting back and having a good holiday in Ireland, and but also opening up those business and academic opportunities. It was good to engage with Northwestern, and a lot of people here in Northwestern are really open about trying to engage with third level institutions in Ireland and trying to build those scientific research opportunities as well. So this one game brings so many other opportunities for Ireland, and I think we know Irish people embrace opportunities like this too.
For sure, and the €147 million figure that's been produced is just an incredible number. So economically, it makes unbelievable sense, and it's a huge opportunity for Ireland. But what about the sporting side of things then, Jack, when you think about the relationship between Ireland and college football, and how Ireland can benefit on a sporting level from an event like this? Like, is that something that you've thought about at all? Because obviously the economic thing is the most important thing, and I'm sure that's been the top of everybody's mind.
Yeah, no, but there's always sporting opportunities with major events, and we have a lot of people who are interested in college football, but also interested in American football. And I think seeing a major event come to Ireland might be a catalyst for a young person to maybe start playing American football, to start playing sport in general. I think the more sporting events we have in Ireland that the people see close to home, it's trying to spring an interest in sport in some way, shape or form, whether it's just getting increased activity. But I think we, from a sporting perspective, it's really positive, and it also shows that Ireland can host major events. Obviously, we're college football is one, but that we want to start with a major events unit in the Department of Sport, and we're looking at a number of opportunities over the next decade to show that Ireland is open to host major events. And
is
the
it
huge
with
benefits
American events. Sorry to interrupt the other opportunities that you're talking about, or is it further afield in America?
Well, all opportunities. So I mean, we want to embrace opportunities that work for Ireland, and I think when major events have come to Ireland in the past, it's brought huge economic opportunities to the country, and also people who have an interest in sport embrace watching them even at home or going to the match itself. So look, it's positive across all aspects.
So there's a major events team is there within the department, and is that a new setup, and what other is there anything else you can tell us, I guess, about any other opportunities that you're planning?
Yeah, so we've a major events unit in the Department of Sport. It was set up in recent years, and we'll be formalising kind of a whole major events policy as well. That's something that we want to do in this as Minister for Sport, but also in the Programme for Government, formalising a major events policy around sport is something we want to try and build on, so that we have a structure that shows how Ireland can host major events. And so, as you know, we're in a process with the UK around the FIFA World Cup at the moment, but we've all a whole other array of other events that some of them may be considered major, some are minor, but it's trying to spring that and be that catalyst for sport in Ireland, and it brings huge economic opportunities for all. And the major events unit is a structure we want to keep as a permanent place so that we can engage with different sports and potential opportunities that work for Ireland.
It's really interesting, like, obviously because the 2023 Rugby World Cup, it didn't go so well from an Irish perspective. I'm sure there was a lot of things that were taken away from that. So how is the FIFA World Cup bit going along these lines then, and what have you learned from maybe this event from the 2023 World Cup failure, if you can use that word, when you're actually trying to get this bid up and running?
Well, there's always learnings from, and we know 2023 World Cup didn't happen, but I think establishing the structure, keeping it there, having it staffed and resourced is something we've had a significant increased allocation of the budget this year for the major events unit, for example, and developing a policy around that so that there's that kind of long-term permanence and there's a structure there and a leadership team, and there is in our major events unit at the moment. The FIFA World Cup bid is progressing, so there's ongoing economic analysis of it. We brought an updated memo to Cabinet there in the last number of weeks as a kind of progress update, and so we're working with the football associations. A bid board is being established, and that will kind of formalise how the bid structure will work, there's ongoing progress in that.
And where is the progress at the moment?
So a bid board is being established, and the representative of the government and of the FAI on that, and there's ongoing kind of economic analysis on the bid and how it would work and that whole piece, and there's detailed analysis ongoing on kind of formalising how it will work across the different footballing nations and between the two governments.
Was there ever any concern on that front about the scenes at the Euro 2020 final at all, and maybe there was some suggestion that should Ireland get into bed with England on this front, considering that the Wembley final was a bit of a disaster from the FA's point of view?
Well, look, this is about 2030, and I think any event where there has to be learnings, and the FA will have to, obviously, I'm sure they've had significant reflection on that. I know they've engaged with obviously UEFA on the learnings on that, and I think that'll be strengthened. But I think we're looking at an event in 2030. We want to see, again, we're ongoing analysis of the economic potential and the bid structure and that, and I think we have to be ambitious about major events and the potential it offers Ireland, and the work is ongoing in that.
Just one last thing I wanted to ask you about, just when it comes to the things that you learned personally from this trip. We just had a tour around this facility, and it's absolutely unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. One of the, I think anybody who comes to a US college and sees their sporting facilities generally gets blown away, especially from an Irish perspective. Obviously, we're talking about a totally different stratosphere when it comes to the resources at their disposal, and the fundraising these people do is incredible. But is there anything that you've learned, or that Ireland as a sporting society can take from the operation that places like Northwestern University operate with?
Well, the facilities and infrastructure are phenomenal, and it's high performance at its best. It's most up-to-date, modern, high performance, and to see it happening within a university campus, and the, you know, the level of training and ambition across the Olympic sports, but also the team sports. I think we can take learnings from the scale of the infrastructure. Like we have a new master plan, for example, for this national sports campus, and ensuring we get more sports in there. You know, develop that synergy around high performance across all the different sports, and our new high performance strategy seeks to do that within the sports campus, and also, you know, building that collaboration between universities and the high performance system. I think we can strengthen that. From a finance perspective, we have increased our allocation for sport in the most recent budget. We've also got a package for the recovery of sport that we secured. I think one of the things that's interesting from here, from engaging with Northwestern, they've got huge philanthropic investment as well, and I think that's something probably Ireland Inc. can maybe do more of as well, and in addition to the state doing more, I think trying to see how we can, you know, embrace that around some infrastructure and across our university system as well. If you look at across the US, how, you know, philanthropic input has really helped the development of facilities and infrastructure, the state is doing more and will do more, and we're ambitious around high performance, but also around building community facilities and infrastructure for local clubs. And I think when people see the sports capital and equipment program in the next number of weeks, you'll see one of the most ambitious, well-funded programs in many, many years. So we're matching our the level of demand from clubs with a significant increased investment. Obviously, major sporting infrastructure like this is a huge scale of investment, and we have the large scale sports infrastructure fund, which has provided and will provide, you know, huge amount of infrastructure. But the facilities of the scale of Northwestern and what you see in other parts of the Midwest are, you know, there are certainly learnings we can take, and the huge benefit it brings to their sporting system. And I think the one thing that's our high performance strategy speaks to is how we can build better collaboration between high performance and universities. And in fairness, that's happening in some universities, it is, but I think they really do it well here. And I suppose as well, you know, what are the philanthropic opportunities where people who are passionate about sport and have been successful, how we can partner with them to try and really build that better infrastructure. And I think there's probably opportunities in that front as well. But we're around sports generally, we're on a good funding trajectory at the moment, and you know, we want to try and deliver on that for clubs and grassroots, for our young people, and but also for our high performance athletes as they get into the Paris cycle, and then as well for across all the other sports as well. Indoor sport has had a particularly challenging time the last 18 months, of seeing the recovery of that is a big priority for me over the next number of weeks and months.
OTB AM
with Gillette, proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's move.